Department, the third quarter of 2011-2012. Both the programs as well as finances. And later on, we'll be looking at the legislative program as to how far is the department planning to process or for us to present bills for us to process. Of course, we welcome that because we really need to know which bills are coming, given that last year we didn't touch anything and the indications are that we're going to have quite a load this year. So we need to know in time, and hopefully one of the things Mamuzungu, we need to do is to see how we can do some guesstimates with regards to the NEDLAC process. Because from the ISMO bill experience, we do all the dreams, only find that the hiccups come out of the NEDLAC process. Of course, it still depends, you know, how far does NEDLAC agree or not agree on a bill. That one understands, but at times one can make some guesstimates so that we can do the planning in good time. Because also, as you know, any time a legislation comes in, if given priority, you know, it pushes other things aside. And once again, compels us to do some forward planning to some degree. Having said that, let me then ask Mr. Kotse if there are any apologies.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've not received any apologies from any members, Chair, but we did, however, receive an apology from the Director General, who, due to ill health, will not be able to attend the meeting.
Thank you very much. Let's put it light and say she's not well, and let's hope it's a speedy recovery. We know she's snowed with work. And also, an apology for me. I am compelled to attend to an urgent meeting around 11 at the Chief Whip's office. So, Honorable Mloto will take over at that time. Having said that, let me hand over now to the department to take us through its quarterly reports. That is the third quarter performance. Third quarter being October, November, December 2012. Thank you, Ladislav. October, November, December 2011. Remember, honourable members, I have said this is part of the budget review cycle. So it will be helpful when we handle this to actually open some little filing on this so that you can be able to monitor it. Otherwise, you end up, you know, forgetting it, you know, because unfortunately, every time we get this quarterly report according to the budget review cycle, we skip, there's always a quarter in between, isn't it? Because all the stuff we have done, even if you do it in time, it has to go through the National Treasury first, which is a little bit of a you know, disarming, issue, but it's unavoidable, that we understand. So, honorable members, it really would be helpful if you could just get our admin support to open just mini files for us so that every time we come, we can be able to relate every quarter with previous quarters. Thanks very much, Mamuzungu. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. The Chairperson has indicated it does become a bit of a challenge when you have to present on a quarter, when we are well almost at the end of the next one, because some of the things that happen that come is the wrong, that is corrected, and those kinds of things. But we will try to keep to the quarter. It there's anything else that has happened significant post the quarter. So I'm saying that if there's anything that has happened post the quarter, we will make mention of that in our presentations. I think as a start, before I start anything, I just want to quickly let the team that we have introduce themselves before I take class through. Start with my neighbor on the right. Chetty, CFO for the Department of Energy.
I'm Muzi Mkhize, Chief Director, Hydrocarbons.
Justin Daniel, Chief Director, Finance, IT and Supply Chain Management.
Nantantan Chabalala, Director, Financial Planning and Management Accounting. Financial Planning and Management Accounting.
And the other gentleman, IT.
Chief Director of Finance, IT, and Supply Chain Management.
Thank you.
And of course, the gentleman who just walked in is Mr. Ompia Panis, our DTG for Electricity, Nuclear, and Clean Energy. Before I start, I've just made aware that there hasn't been any formal apologies from the side of the minister. The minister was last week requested by the president to go to Kuwait. That's where she is right now. She's coming back at the end of the week. And she's taken with her our DDG for hydrocarbons, Mr. Makubela. The deputy minister has had to attend the launch of the Wind Atlas here in Cape Town on behalf of the minister. And of course, the DG, unfortunately, she is off sick. She's been from last Friday.
And once again, you guys, you make sure that something which we would like to attend coincides with our meeting.
Which one is that? Oh, the Devon one. Oh, the Wind Atlas.
This is what you did last week as well. Is it by default or by design? Okay, carry on.
Okay.
Obviously, honorable member, we really would have loved to pop in, eh? So please think about that in future. The CEO here and one DTG at least can represent us to the department, and the CFO can really represent us. But please, when you plan, think that from time to time, we really would like to pop in, even if we could have been there for 30 minutes, to show support and to get an exposure. Thank you.
Okay. No, we'll do that, Chairperson. Considering that this month is going to be a very busy month for us, being the energy month as declared by the minister. So as it is in the department at the moment, we are very thin in terms of management because two of our DDGs are out of circulation, all our principals are out of circulation, and some of the chief directors. But we'll do our best with the people we've got along here, and also especially on the finance side, just to give them an indication of what is expected from finance going forward from this committee. Our presentation today, as indicated, is talking to our third quarter performance for the 2011-12 financial year. What we'll do, we'll go after the introduction, which covers more or less just the highlights for the quarter. We'll go through the bench performance reviews, which will include the support services. We'll do it collectively. For support services, it should be the CEO's office, corporate services branch. The CFO will present the financial report, not under this presentation, so it's independent, and then hydrocarbons and energy planning, and then electricity, nuclear, and clean energy. And then after that, we'll have a look at the CFO's report, followed by the budget, sorry, followed by the legislation. The next slide just briefly identifies for the committee what we consider as our highlights for the period for the 3 months. That's during the last quarter of last year, we were part of the hosting of the COP17. It was a very successful event. For the Department of Energy, we participated in 23 energy site events, and I think these are the most events that were offered by any government department during the COP17. During that period, we also completed the IPP bidding process and announced the successful bids for the 1415 megawatts. During the period also, we launched the South African Renewable Energy Initiative, which I will talk to a bit later.
We also had the new multi-purpose pipeline commissioned, which doesn't mean that we have finished our payment yet. We had a number of international engagements that our principals were involved in. Also during that period, between ourselves and the Department of Public Works, we finalized the relocation of the Department of Energy to the old land bank building in Pretoria. We're hoping that by the end of this year, I'm giving us a very long lead time just to make sure that if it happens sooner, then we're all pleasantly surprised. But we're hoping that within the next couple of months, we'll be able to move to our own building, which is going to have independence just for the Department of Energy and also provide accommodation, which we are really, really struggling with at the moment. We've got a lot of people sitting in the passage, some people sharing offices at the moment. It's quite a difficult situation.
Why don't you bring us some photos?
Of the new building?
No, no. People sitting in the passage.
No, we will. Because all we do, we just put a wall in front of them. That is literally in the passage.
No, we need to know those things.
Okay.
We need to know that. I'm sure all of members, I can see they are nodding. Because, see, sorry to interject. One of the fundamentals is that if we are to be firm with you and to be assertive about delivery, we should ensure there is requisite resource deployment as well, or resource allocation. They do go hand in hand. Sometimes when I learned about performance agreements, I was told that that's the other side of the coin. You insist on someone ensuring that person performs, but at the same time we ensure that their requisite resources are located. Just keep that in mind, Mama.
No, Chair, we'll definitely do that. Also, during the same period, we conducted a few awareness and information sharing sessions. Some of them included our session on the PPAA, which is the Petroleum Product Amendment Act and the licensing process. I'm sure Mr. Mkhize will take us through the examples of that. Also, during the same period, of course, we had our annual planning session where we looked at our mid-term performance in terms of our plans, in terms of our finances, and also look at what needs to be changed or what needs to be expedited for the latter part of the year. So that's basically the highlights that we went through as a department last year. Coming to the support services, within the COO's office, of course, the November Department Strategic Planning Session, which is the responsibility of the branch, was conducted, and we were able to submit the November draft, because now what government has done with the outcomes-based approach of planning, as governments, we have to produce three sets of annual performance plans, the first set being at the end of August, which is the first draft. And then after you've done your strategic planning session as a department, then you produce your second draft. And then after the State of the Nation and then the government budget speech, then you present your last draft, which would be the one tabled in Parliament, which we did at the end of last month. Within the SOE oversight, there was nothing that standing out in terms of the activities in the department. We've gone through the normal quarterly performance report, which they make to the minister. As the shareholder, they've also submitted, because starting from this year, the Schedule 3 is now a part of the annual performance plan process.
Schedule 3 versus Schedule 1, Schedule 2.
Sorry, Schedule 3 versus Schedule 2.
No, that's for us to have a sense of the differences between
okay.
A Schedule 1 and a Schedule 2 entity.
Okay.
If you don't mind.
In the Department of Energy, we've got two sets of entities, three of them that belong to the Schedule 3. That will be your NNR, your NERSA, and your SANEDI. And then two of them belong to Schedule 2, which are the big businesses. That will be yourself, group of companies, and NEXA. Those are classified under Schedule 2 in the PFMA.
What would be under Schedule 1?
We don't.
So I think you want to know what the real distinction. What can a Schedule 2 do that a Schedule 3 can't?
Oh, Chair, Schedule 2 under the PFMA are those that have certain borrowing powers that allow them to get external finance without going through the limitations that would restrict the Schedule 3 and so on. Let me give an example that Eskom, Transnet, and them can go on their own bond issues, so they can approach the international markets and borrow against their balance sheet, and it's prescribed in the PFMA, in Section 66, as to how they go about doing that. So once they have informed their shareholder and the Minister of Finance, they can borrow under Schedule 3. When it comes to Schedule 3, as an example, they do not have any borrowing powers. They would have appropriations from Parliament, and that would be it. So they would not be able to borrow or over and above what has been appropriated from Parliament. If they need additional money, they have to then approach, you know, government again to raise more money. So this thing goes. Schedule 1 would be would not be a company. Schedule 1 is typically your department, your Chapter 9 institutions, and those kind of things.
I think, Mam Zongo, it would be helpful when the state-owned entities, our own energy state-owned entities, they should just indicate that every time they present themselves, so that we are able to remember where and who they are. It just struck my mind, it's good to know under which categories do they come in. Because now, recently, we've got SARI joining the club, we've got SANEDI, which should be something else. So the level at which they are and operate would help us as well to understand how far they can, or their mandate or their authority is in terms of operating. Thank you. Yes.
Just a quick remark. The reason why I came to know about it is you have to keep on watching. There are some who would want to sneak in and become Schedule 3 and sometimes support the department. I'm not talking about this department. I'm talking about other ones which are through it, and then they become allied into the state where they go into this borrowing powers without a strong balance sheet.
In fact, one of the things that would help us most is that if at some stage we need as a committee to apply our minds and maybe recommend that one should be upgraded or one should be demoted, whichever direction, it would be just helpful to just as a matter of just as you know, small caption, if I can call it, just to say we as NNR, who are a Schedule 3 entity. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We'll do that. Except that when you've been working there for such a long time, you tend to take a lot of things for granted. So anyway, as I was saying, that our Schedule 3, which is your NNR, much over and above the funding that they get or from the first class, they do have authorization fees, which they, through permission from Treasury, they have to get from the people that they regulate. So what they produce, as I said, indicated that in the past they didn't have to produce any of their strat plans or table them. Those are tabled as part of the department's strat plan together with their annual performance plans. But from this year they've been split. Now they table their own independently, just the Schedule 3s. And then the Schedule 2s, which should be yourself, group of companies together with Nexa, those are still in the old system where they produce their strat plans as part of their shareholder contract to the shareholder. So this is the relationship that they have administratively. Also, during the same period, Chairperson, continuing that, the department signed a number of agreements and declarations of interest with South Korea, with Ghana, with Denmark, Lesotho, DRC, the International Energy Agency, and SARI, which of course was represented by Germany, Norway, UK, Denmark, and the European Investment Bank. I will take you through briefly on what each one of them does at a later stage. These agreements, of course, they cover the access to capacity building, they cover the issues of funding for clean energy technology, they cover exchange of information and development of energy infrastructure, increase in generation capacity, but most of them are actually focusing on clean energy projects. within the area of corporate services, which will include your HR, your communication, and legal services, just a few highlights that you wanted to make this morning is that as at the end of the quarter, which ended December 2011, the department had a capacity of 566 staff, as compared to just over 900, which has been approved by the Minister and Department of DPSA. The vacancy rate for that period was sitting at 7.77% with 44 vacant posts. What made that number quite high, because I know it would concern a lot of us, including the members of the committee, is the fact that towards the end of last year, we were given permission by National Treasury to establish the IPP unit within the department. So those vacancies mostly are for the IPP unit, because at that time, at December, we were just getting ready the adverts. The way already is part of our structure, but then we're getting ready the adverts for the position that will be created within the unit. So that's what pushed our vacancy number a bit high. So once the unit is sorted out, the number is going to go down. The HR plan, which was approved at the end of September 2011, was implemented during the quarter, focusing mostly on the skills needs of the department, on the structure of the department, because I don't know if members remember that the last time Mr. Mguni presented on the interim structure and the approved structure, he indicated that we've just done the macro organizational structure, which just identifies the different branches within the department. Now we had to move from there to the lower level, so within each branch, which chief directors are you going to have? What are the functions of each position and the level of the position? So this is what we've started doing to try and see. The plan was to say as we start the year 2012-13, we have a complete structure indicating all the vacancies and all the positions that we require for the department to address its mandate. In terms of the skills development plan of the department, we had a total of 347 employees who received training to enhance performance and productivity to date. That figure is for the year, not just for the quarter. And also during the same period, we completed the consultation process on the final macro-organizational structure, as already indicated. Within the communication environment, we did, I think last year, the chief director came to this committee to present her program for the year in terms of public participation program. So for that quarter, we had six events, which were in Northern Cape, in Limpopo, Eastern Cape, and KZN. Most of them were information sharing, switch-ons, and also any other information that the department wanted to extend. This is part of the program, the way we have to have our principals having 10 events per year each. 96% of the presidential hotline queries were addressed during that period. Most of them, of course, were in the area of INEP, where people were had concerns about electrification that is not coming to that area. They had electrification islands that were worried about. Also, in that process, they were also looking at the issue of petroleum licenses. So 96% of those hotlines were sorted out for that quarter. Most of them, the 4% was mostly in the area of where we had to transfer those queries to other departments. Most of them would go to ESCOM, where they are specific to say in this area this did not happen. So ESCOM had to come up with an answer of what actually happened there. 100% of our media queries were responded to during the period, because I don't think we can afford to ignore the media. So we make sure that we comply or respond to them within the time given. Also, late last year, the department came and presented to the members our special programs and outreach programs. This is an area where we're focusing on women and youth empowerment. So what we did for the quarter is that the C3E, which is the Clean Energy Women Empowerment, if members would remember, this is an organization that has been formed by 8 different governments, where our minister has been designated as the Africa Clean Energy Ambassador. So what we did last year in August, we launched that in South Africa with the aim of saying that if funding allowing and, of course, the timing, we wanted to launch the African chapter of the Clean Energy Africa, which is the C3E Africa. So last quarter, we were successful in forming working groups. which are focusing on mentorships, on internships, on coaching, clean energy ambassadorships. The reason I'm mentioning that is because this arrangement is actually happening between the department and the SOEs that report to the department, other government department, other role players in the energy sector. Because what we're trying to say, we're trying to introduce young girls as early as primary school into a clean energy environment. So we need coaches, we need internships, we need mentorships. So we've had a lot of interest in the private sector in getting involved in this project to offer their companies, to offer their batteries. Because how we do it, we say to them, we're not asking you to give us an extra battery, because when you say that to companies, they say we have to budget for that for the next cycle, which is going to be in 3 years' time. So what we say to them, we say, if in your company you've got 10 batteries, for example, can you offer us one for clean energy so that it's within your budget for next year? You don't have to go and all you're saying that one of those batteries, just let us share in terms of our clean energy program. So there's been a very big interest in that area, which is a good sign for us. Also, during the same period, we conducted a study in partnership with the United Nations Development Program, which is the Barefoot India Women Solar Engineering Project. We had a few women that were sent to India to go and learn some of the clean energy, the building of the panels. They are back in the country, but now what we're trying to do, we're trying to expand that program also to make sure that the women that have gone there, they've got something to do, because it's one of the challenges that we normally have within government, that between government and government, we have this kind of arrangements. When these people come back to the country, in most cases, they don't have a forum or a platform to do what they were doing. Most of them, those that don't have funding, because most of them, we get them from the rural areas, they don't have funding to start anything. So what we are working on now within the electricity, with the electrification program and this special programs unit, is to work on how best we can assist the ones who are already in the country and also make sure that we bring the manufacturing back into the country, whatever they've left. If they've got any parts they're going to be bringing together, it must be done within the ones that are developed in the country. Also, during the 16 days of activism for no violence against women and children, the department launched our DOE Men's Forum, which was chaired, of course, by the Deputy Minister. I was in there, so I won't say much about it. I'm not sure about the gentlemen around me, if they were there. But I've been advised that they have come up with their charter, and they are promising to be very good to the rest of us in that department, and that is...
They will share that with us down the line, as they usually frequent. No, seriously, as they usually frequent Parliament, they'll bring us a copy of the charter.
Yeah.
Baba Mkize, Baba Abba.
No, we'll definitely get them to do that. Also, in partnership with the Department of Securing, we managed to get sponsorship for 16 solar panels for 16 houses which were donated during the 16 days in MLO as a department. So these are just basically the highlights of the unit, the special programs and outreach projects. It's just that it does become a bit difficult, Chairperson, before I hand over to my colleagues. This is one of the very difficult months, because starting from October, you start being interference of the attendance of employees because of the exams. So from mid-November, you run with half your staff from mid-October into November. Then November, people are getting ready for holidays. Then you have the month of December as well, which is also another challenge, because people have to go on holiday. And by the time, I promise you, December comes, all of us are walking like zombies in the department. So we really have to go and leave. So it was a fairly short quarter in terms of the performance, but we've tried to make sure that the targets that we have are reached. If anything else has been outstanding, it has to be pushed to the last quarter, which is the March quarter. Thank you, Chairperson. I'll hand over to Mr. Mkize.
Thank you very much, Kavaze.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and members of the portfolio committee, for the opportunity. to present on how far we've gone in terms of the third quarter of 2011-2012. As highlighted, is that we had the multi-product pipeline. We as a department, from our responsibility of ensuring security of supply, we are the ones that are responsible for the final disbursement of the money that is required by Transnet as government's contribution to the construction of the NMTP. The trunk line of the new multi-product pipeline was constructed, and we had to also play a role in the feeding of the line with product, because the pipeline without the product does not help, because it's inoperable. One needs to feed it completely with product, so that as one pushes the product in, product comes out at the end of the pipeline. So that was done during the December period, and hence the line was then commissioned in January. We are responsible for the payment of the grant funding in terms of the grant funding agreement, which is 375 million. That is done every quarter, or I say at the end of every quarter, which for all practical reasons means that you actually pay during the month after the quarter is closed. So though it's quarter three, December, it will reflect that payment was not done. It was actually effected in January 2012. And that the payment also for the end of this quarter is in process and is going to be paid before the end of this month. So in terms of the payment, everything is in order. And then we also had to look at the regulatory accounting system, which is a very important issue for the industry here, because they want to get their requisite return on the investment that they make in the industry. With regard to that, we did have the model and the regulatory manual guidelines being approved during November 2011, and then the margins were then incorporated in the December 2012 fuel pricing. We call this one a rapid RAS, because to go full force with the RAS, with the rapid with the regulatory accounting system, one has to change the element, the pricing elements, as well as go through the network process. So we have given ourselves 2 years as a maximum in agreement with the industry to look at the proper phasing in of the regulatory accounting system. The regulatory accounting system, in essence, ensures that you ring fence the regulated entities or regulated activities from the non-regulated one, so that there's no cross-subsidization. And also to give the requisite return so as to promote investment in the sector. We also embarked on the improving biofuels uptake.
Kavazan. This regulatory accounting system, honorable members, is quite interesting. If you pick up what he said at the end, that is to ensure there's no cross subsidization, number one, and to ensure it facilitates investment, requisite investment.
Yeah.
Now, am I assuming correctly that you have not yet shared with us the regulator accounting system? Is it a technical thing? Can you maybe in one of these days arrange, maybe when you come and make whatever you think, you just spend about 20 minutes explaining it to us? How about that, honorable members? If it has these profound implications or impact, the preemption of cross-subsidization, number one. Number two, facilitation of investment. So those are the kind of areas that we'll be interested in. It's not about telling us to get the technical aspects, but just looking at it in principle and generally. I'm sure the committee secretary is listening. We can look at one of those things and see if you know, that area can just be given its own 15, 20 minutes to elaborate on. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair. The other project was the improvement of the biofuels uptake. as we know that the biofuel national strategy that was approved by cabinet in 2007 and then had to come into operation, unfortunately there hasn't been much headway. The reason being cited was lack of a pricing framework as well as the whole regulatory framework around the biofuels to be able to incentivize or support biofuel manufacturers. This project straddles between two chief directorates, one under electricity, which deals with clean energy, and ourselves as hydrocarbons, because once we have the biofuels produced, you then need to use them as liquid fuels, or in other words, mix them or blend them together with the conventional or mineral fuels so that it can be used to run vehicles. So we undertook two projects. One project was on the blending value. We determined the blending value of bioethanol. Because of its nature, bioethanol it's got a lot of water in it, so it attracts water and therefore runs the risk of causing corrosion, etc., and the challenges of handling that bioethanol in the logistical system of supplying fuel. But at the same time, it also offers some benefits in terms of its octane value, because it's got a higher octane rating, and therefore gives value. Plus, it will also add volume one to the fuel pool. So we had to then determine what the value is going to be. The value that these oil companies will derive in blending by ethanol with conventional mineral fuels. That is one project. And then the other one was on determination of the break-even cost or break-even price that this a typical biofuel manufacturer would have to charge, so that, in other words, he is able to break even in terms of the cost versus the price. So that determination was completed in December, in terms of the submission to the minister and the acceptance of the reports that were done by the consultant. And then we had the mandatory blending regulations that were published on the 16th of September for public comment, and they closed on 18th of November in terms of receiving those comments. We received quite a substantial number of comments, and unfortunately we could not have any meeting sooner than what we anticipated. We wanted to close off in December to have all this done, but because people were also away on leave, so we had to have a stakeholder engagement meeting scheduled for January, which was then postponed to February because of people are not very so we had that concerning the planning regulation. We've had the workshop, and now we are at the final stages of incorporating the comments. This Friday, we are going to have a stakeholder engagement meeting to deal with the pricing framework, and more specifically deal with the outcomes of the blending value as well as the break-even price for biofuel, which is for biodiesel and bioethanol. What maybe I would like the House here to note is the fact that when one determines the break-even cost, one looks at the more economically viable crops. So there is a selection of crops, for example, in bioethanol. You would use sorghum as well as sugar cane, and then with the biodiesel, you put the soya as one. And we are going to have that, as I said, that discussion, a workshop on this coming Friday, so that we can be able to then have our starting point in terms of really having a pricing framework to see how much are we going to supply and how much are we going to be able, what sort of assistance will be required. The challenge there is that we need to look at situation of maybe assisting the biofuel manufacturers in more or less much the same way as it was done for the synthetic fuel producers. So with that one, we have our own principles as a department that we have developed so far. That we're also going to engage with the stakeholders to say this is how we envisage that we can support you at the time when you've got you are making lots of profits, you are able to put money in the kit to support you during the dark days. That kind of a principle. So I would say there we've progressed well. And then there was also generally what we put there as a pro-poor or low pro-low income household pricing initiative. We're looking at this because most of the time, particularly from a hydrocarbon standpoint, is that most of the things that we are dealing with sometimes they tend to not have obvious relevance to the poor and in terms of poverty alleviation. So we had to look at that, and with respect to that, we looked at paraffin. We have a project that was conducted to see what can be done to make sure that the price of paraffin, the retail price, is based on a fixed margin for the retailer instead of a percentage, which is 30%. So what happens is that when the price of paraffin increases, the retail margin for paraffin also increases without the retailer actually having incurred additional cost, because it is a percentage thing. So like if you've got say 10 rand coming in, then it's going to be 13 rand, because there's this 10% that there's 30% that comes in. So we wanted to have a fixed margin for the retailer, so that at least when the prices go up, the margin does not unduly increase and therefore result in higher costs for the paraffin users. That has been done, and now during the quarter there was a request for approval to publish the final report for public comment, and I'm glad to say that report has already been approved, and now we're publishing it for public comment, which we are then going to engage as part of our process of developing prices. When it comes to the integrated energy centers, pardon me, there's an eye that went away there. I don't know how come. But it's integrated energy centers establishment. These are just one-stop energy service centers. Mainly for now, they are more focused on service stations. But what happens is that they also offer a place where people can go for information on energy services, as well as also offer other products like LPG. We're looking at also enhancing them to include the modern energy carriers, also including the clean energy side of things, like the solar, just for people to be informed as well as be able to access those services. It's also part of what has been identified as services that can be rendered, especially on the poverty in other areas, as part of stimulating special development and economic development in those areas, particularly looking at the rural hinterlands of the country. There was one that was earmarked for Ulundi and Kwakwa. The construction for the Lumbi IEC, they moved in the site to prepare the area. Unfortunately, that had to stop because of safety concerns around that construction company. That is the Sasol site. The one also of Kwakwa IEC. It will commence in the first quarter of 2012. So, it will commence there. We have launched that one on the 12th of. There was a short training on the 12th of January 2012 for Kwakwa IEC. Sometimes, even if you want to progress as quickly as a department, it's not that it was some part, the local municipalities involved. There are cooperatives, because currently what is happening is that we as a department do not actually make investment in terms of financial investment, but we work together with an oil company, bring an oil company on board as a partner, and work together with the municipality as well with the community to develop this IEC. And then when it's developed, it's run by a cooperative, which is formed by community members, because it's a community-based project. We have experienced challenges in terms of the running of these IECs by cooperatives. And with the different companies, we are also working with them to get, maybe to look at various other models to of ownership so that they can be continued. Because the challenge that we have had is the continuity, where we find also people in the department, some the members that are belonging to this section, having a lot of work to do to help with the operation of the IEC. Because also the skills development challenge creeps in there, where you find that the cooperative members, the board, they cannot, in terms of the business acumen to run this IEC, it becomes a challenge. And we have to step in from time to time to us. The strategic policy, particularly this has come to light now with the recent challenges around Iran and other geopolitical events. What has happened with that one is that during the quarter, the draft document and cabinet memo was forwarded for approval. The submission has since been approved by the minister and looks set to be presented during March 2012. The latest information that I have was that it was supposed to be dealt with tomorrow in cabinet. And then the other issue that we looked at was the storage and distribution infrastructure gap analysis report, where we look at the infrastructure update. This is done on a monthly basis. And then the other one that we looked at is the increased domestic refining capacity. With this one, it actually incorporates the 20-year liquid fuel infrastructure roadmap, which we call the 20-year plan for liquid fuel infrastructure. The challenge there is getting the data. We got the consultant to do this project for us, and we arranged ourselves as a different work stream, looking at different segments of the whole supply chain, where people are looking at refining, others will look at maybe port infrastructure, others will look at the retailing side of things, but through that very chain. And 80% of data has been collected there, and there was analysis of data that had begun. But what kind of put some kind of lull in terms of the rate of developing the project was that there was a need for us to then do a refinery audit. But the refinery audit is part of the liquid fuel infrastructure roadmap, but it's just that we had to expand and expedite the refinery side of things, where we had to do the refinery audit. The refinery audit is currently on the go. There are various refinery things that are being done currently, and I understand that the team that is working on this will be planning to visit Chevron here in Cape Town. Sasol in Secunda has already been visited as part of the refinery audit process. Then the development of regulations and on the SPG and SPG price licensing framework. The draft SPG strategy document together with cabinet will be forwarded for internal review. We still are waiting the unfolding of that internal review. Then in terms of the revised specifications and standards, the Cleaner Fuels 2 and regulations to be promulgated. The way we anticipated was by then would have promulgated the regulation. I gave last week I gave a report, a presentation on this fuel specifications and standards, and highlighted the issue of the cleaner fuels to cost recovery mechanism or incentives being really the one area that is really challenging. And that the stakeholder workshop, the draft regulations have already been done, and the draft has been sent to our legal unit for Perusa. Then we also had a legislative think I don't know whether to go on, talk to it now, or leave it here to deal with the legislative problem later.
Just give it a few seconds because it's part of this, but don't dwell on it.
Okay. In this sense, we've got the gas amendment bill, which as well as the petroleum product amendment bill that was considered. The gas amendment bill has been developed, and the consultation process was underway during the quarter. I'm glad to say that that amendment bill has been concluded internally and approved by the minister, and now we are looking at the next cabinet setting to be able to present it. Because we had a slight delay during the period, it's much earlier. That is why we looked at February. Everything was concluded, but unfortunately, we had one of the key members that was working on the bill. Who is well qualified in terms of legislative drafting, leaving the department in November to join SOE. So that was a challenge. We also had challenges generally in terms of capacity related, but we undertook a legislative drafting course, which has assisted greatly in terms of progress. With regard to the Petroleum Products Amendment Bill, the internal drafting process is underway. We had a problem there related to the issue of the drafting process. As I've said, that we then appealed ourselves and we were underway. One of the things that we have seen with that draft amendment bill, we were thinking of repealing the whole act and then just coming up with a new bill. After discussion, we resorted to do an amendment because of the complications that might arise based also on the information we gathered during the legislative drafting course that we underwent. Then this is hydrocarbons. Then in terms of the petroleum controller, there was the issue of the arbitration, the processing it within 14-day turnaround period. The complexity of arbitration, legal documents and supporting documents to consider in processing arbitration requests resulted in us not necessarily doing that within that 14-day turnaround period. But that arbitration process it depends on, it's not a steady stream of arbitration, because it depends if some parties are at odds, then they need to undertake an arbitration. During the quarter, only one arbitration was received. Then the other one is on the compliance monitoring and enforcement in the petroleum sector, which deals with site inspections, like mainly the retail site inspections. 411 site inspections were conducted during the period. I don't want to now come with a remix of the song that we always sing around capacity or expertise, but we're able to still do that 411 site inspection.
And that's the ideal number we would have loved to have done.
I will say that although I don't have the fixed number with me here, it's not just about the number only. It's the number and the kind of test that one does to be able to, like for example, to look at the fuel that is there, being able to take samples and not only have visual site inspection, to do more of also the sampling in terms of testing the quality of the fuel. So these are the things that come in when we are doing this site inspection. And I think this is also related to the issue that I raised earlier on the petroleum product amendment bill. Because one of the things that we want to enhance then is compliance monitoring and enforcement to be able to impose penalties and fines, because the way the act is does not allow this kind of, you see, to find a person doing something wrong, you must give the person a chance to correct, and then you keep going through the process, which does not help at the end of the day. And then the other one is to educate the public on the act itself and licensing. That has been done in Mpumalanga, Limpopo, Durban, Northern Cape, Eastern Cape, and Western Cape. They've been done by the regional office to do the awareness campaigns, and also there's a schedule for all regions. The regional structures are seeing that they've really improved in terms of functioning in this regard, as well as being able to accept a license application. Then in energy planning, with energy, regard to energy planning, there's this issue of the IEP, where some appreciate the fact that we are also busy, as we're busy with 20-year liquid infrastructure roadmap, it will then feed into this IEP, as well as the IRP 2010 from the electricity side will also feed into the total IEP, which will then fall inside our energy planning as a whole, because energy planning is not just a question of hydrocarbon, it's the whole energy space. An expert on scenario planning was appointed to conduct a review of the methods used to determine the scenarios for the IEP. This review has been concluded, and an interdepartmental steering committee on the development of IEP met on 17 November 2011. This is part of the stakeholder consultation on the IEP itself, the methodology to use, the approach that we need to then change. Then, in terms of getting energy data, the final consultation of the state law advisor on regulation for the provision of data was completed, and the comments from the state law advisor were incorporated. A submission and requesting approval for the final regulation by the minister was submitted before proclamation by the president. So this is part of what is going to help in terms of energy planning to make it mandatory upon these entities to submit or provide information to the department. So the DG's approval has been obtained for the release of the energy balance data for 2009. And the 2010 price report with data for 2009 and 2010 report has been published. So a policy analysis framework for the IEP has also been developed.
I will hand over to Mr. Apani now to proceed from the electricity side. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, I will do the electricity, nuclear and clean portion of this. If I can start with the electrification program. At that point, in the third quarter, we had done 43,000 connections on the ESCOM side and 13,000 on the municipal side. Just to also indicate that I think honorable members need to be aware that at that point, municipalities are only just starting their financial year after 1 July. So typically what happens is that they would lag ESCOM in relation to the number of connections that they would have completed. And this would ramp up around this time towards the third and the fourth quarters for the municipality. And ESCOM would complete all their connections by end of March of that year. We also did 5,764 off-grid connections. This is in relation to the solar home systems program, where four concessionaires provide those technologies as opposed to grid connections. We completed two substations with a target of 10, and eight were still under construction at that time. There was also the matter of cushioning the poor through IBT. I apologize, IBT stands for inclining block tariffs. So the plan at that point had been that ESCOM had fully converted the prepaid meters to inclining block tariffs in line with the provisions of the regulatory determination by NERSA, but municipalities had not completed that. So we had set out to target the metros first, and then hopefully by around 2015 complete the conversion of all prepaid meters in municipalities to inclining block tariffs. Side by side with that, Chair, if I move on to the electricity distribution rehabilitation program, the so-called ADAM, or Approach to Distribution Asset Management, what had happened is that we had prepared an internal strategy document for approval, which was approved and also prepared or approached the executive cabinet for their buy-in in relation to the ADAM philosophy, and the reports in that regard had been completed. In terms of the approach, sorry, maybe before we move off, just in terms of the ADAM approach is that what we intend to do is to close the backlog of some 30 billion rands relating to municipal infrastructure rehabilitation, and we would start with the metros and then progressively work our way through the 187 licensed municipalities. And the idea there is that we would not only rehabilitate the infrastructure but make sure that there is also the regulatory and institutional arrangement to make sure that we don't go back in another 10 years with the same municipal program. So this is very critical, particularly as we make substantial capital investments on the generation and transmission side. Okay, so if I can move on to the next one, which is the nuclear program. Here we're specifically dealing with two matters, the one relating to the nuclear power plant program, and then secondly dealing with the, if you like, the institutional and facilitation of a nuclear program in this country in line with the nuclear energy policy and the Nuclear Energy Act. So what we had done regarding the first one, which is the introduction of the power program, the nuclear power program, was that waste being one of the most critical elements, or waste management, was that the establishment of the National Nuclear Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute had been advanced, and it was listed in terms of the PFMA. And Chair, your question, it is a Schedule 3A PFMA listed entity that was completed, but unfortunately due to the budget constraints starting in 2012-13, we were not able to obtain any funds for its operationalization. Yes, yeah. So the National Nuclear the National Nuclear Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute has been listed. It has been established by legislation, but we have since postponed its operationalization until the next financial year. In other words, 2013-14. Then the issue around the legislation itself that governs the nuclear sector, two pieces of legislation under review, the National Nuclear Act and its regulations, and secondly, the National Nuclear Regulator Act, particularly in regard to the impact that those that the nuclear energy program would have on the existing legislation. So the review was mainly to check if there were any fatal flaws or gaps in the existing legislation that needed to be closed. And Chair, we will be approaching the committee next or in the coming financial year with proposals around the amendments that we wish to propose. Perhaps more significantly was that we had then obtained at that point buy-in from the different government departments regarding the National Nuclear Energy Executive Coordinating Committee. This NNEECC, as we call it, is the supreme around the nuclear build program. And underneath it would be all the technical work for decision making by the NNEECC. At that point, we had obtained cabinet approval for its establishment. As you might already be aware, it's chaired by the deputy president, the deputy chair being the Minister of Energy, and virtually all government departments, most, let me not say all, but most government departments are represented on this body, including National Treasury, Economic Development, DTI, Science and Technology, DPE, Department of Energy. I don't know who else has left out. But it's perhaps fair to say that it's a very broad-based platform for decision making by government on the nuclear program. If I move on to the next issue, which was around clean energy, is that at that time, the first window of the renewable energy IPP program was closed on the 4th of November. And as already been indicated, we received a number of proposals and appointed 28 preferred bidders with the intention that they would reach financial close by June of this year. So the process of reaching financial close is underway, and indications are that, in fact, some of the first megawatts under the program will start getting into the system before June of this year. Over and above that, we have a program in relation to energy efficiency, in particular one sub-program relating to solar water heating. Just to recap, 1 million is our political target by 2014, but the intention there is obviously that all roofs in South Africa that need or that use electricity for water heating would be converted to solar. At that point, and again between the municipal and the Eskom rebate program, is that from the fiscals, I think we had some 30 million rands and 729 systems was the snapshot at that point that, of systems that had been installed. And on the rebate side, 47,470 systems had been completed. Unfortunately, I can't give you a breakdown as to which one would be high pressure and which would be low pressure, but predominantly it is on the low pressure side that these systems are installed. Maybe I need to indicate that the snapshot is that we are firmly on track. We had installed some 220,000 solar water heaters so far, whereas the intention was to install 250,000 by the end of this financial year. And we believe that with the allocation of additional funds, we will easily achieve that one target of 1 million by 2014. Well, there are other problems, and as you are well aware, we did discuss some of the issues that worry us around the program, as opposed to just the number chasing. And then the solar park initiative is that, just again to recap, the solar park concept was developed. We did a pre-feasibility study around concentrating certain regions for solar park or solar technology development, including solar PV, photovoltaic, in other words, and also concentrating solar power. The idea being that perhaps if we concentrate them in a certain area, we might be able to achieve certain objectives, including firstly that we would achieve the economies of scale that would bring the costs down. Secondly is that we would make it easy for approvals. The approvals process around the introduction of power plants is very complex and can be very demanding, and we wanted to facilitate that. But also from a government perspective is that we wanted to ensure that we would facilitate that through the construction of certain support infrastructure. That pre-feasibility was completed, and we had then set our a target to complete the feasibility study by the end of 2011-12, in other words, by the end of this month. The tender documents for the appointment of the service providers to undertake the feasibility were issued in that time, in other words, in the third quarter of last year. There had been some problems experienced with, I can record now, with the access to the land itself, but it's something that we are dealing with. And the point there is that, you know, one cannot proceed with a feasibility study whereas the land availability has not been secured. Then another part of the, like the basket of clean energy and energy efficiency programs is in relation to municipal energy efficiency, in other words, the residential sector, but also the industrial and the commercial sectors. In that space, we had negotiated the energy efficiency campaign strategy with the social partners at NEDLAC, and government, business, labor, and civil society had then agreed on a framework, because one of the biggest issues around energy efficiency and its, shall we say, lack of penetration is awareness around it, education and awareness building around it. And we had thought it would be necessary for us to get buy-in from government social partners. This was achieved, and the energy efficiency campaign strategy was completed in that quarter. This targets mainly, you know, it's an umbrella strategy covering all sectors, domestic, industrial, commercial, and so on. But specifically in relation to industrial, where the biggest savings could be made, as we indicated last time, Chair, some 80% of all electricity consumption in this country happens in that space. We have then entered into a review process regarding the Energy Efficiency Accord. The Energy Efficiency Accord had been signed in 2004-05, that time, and unfortunately it had only covered certain companies. It had not covered the whole spectrum of industry, and there was a sense that perhaps we were, some companies were not, it was not easy for them to volunteer to become energy efficient. So we had then established the Energy Efficiency Leadership Network, which was launched in that quarter, in partnership with the business organizations rather than with the companies, but with the specific companies, the National Business Initiative, incorporating a whole group of affiliates under this accord. This was, as I indicated, as part of the campaign strategy. And then that is on the, if you like, on the voluntary side. These are accords and so on. But on the, if you like, on the stick side, so to speak, we also negotiated the energy efficiency regulations. Amendments were made to the Income Tax Act, particularly regarding regulation section 12L and 12I, in terms of which there would be certain, shall we say, incentives provided to those companies that proved that they were more energy efficient by way of giving them tax breaks. So similar to the other, shall we say, basket of tax breaks that you would receive, energy efficiency has been introduced as one of those elements that would make companies pay less tax simply by being more energy efficient. That was published, and the public comments period closed in that quarter on the 15th of November, to be specific. And as we speak, the 12L is ready to be implemented. Chair, what we did not indicate on the slide, which perhaps completes the loop, is that that completes the suite of carrots, so to speak, incentives on the one side. But on the stick side, what we are negotiating right now is what we call the Energy Conservation Scheme. in terms of which the same companies would be required to achieve certain levels of energy efficiency. So you achieve energy efficiency and you get tax breaks. The other side of it is if you're not energy efficient, then the provisions of the energy conservation scheme would kick in, and those would be penalties that would be levied on those companies that were that failed to reach their target energy savings. Chair, we have another program that relates to the clean energy incentive basket, which is the clean development mechanism under the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Very briefly, what this does is that it allows for the amount of energy that is saved, represented by carbon, for that to be traded under the Kyoto Protocol. And the entity that is responsible for that within the department is called the Designated National Authority. And one of the challenges that we have seen is that there's a lot of movement on the grid side of energy efficiency. In other words, there are lots of projects where people save energy in relation to electricity, but there's been very little movement in relation to the other sectors, including transport. You know, the side of energy efficiency has shown very little progress. Transport sector booklet was developed and printed. This is mainly around, you know, awareness building and making sure that there is, you know, more dissemination of information around the clean development mechanism for energy efficiency. And we also held, as part of our stakeholder and public participation program, a number of workshops in the different provinces. We covered four provinces, and we covered just one sector. The idea there is that we would achieve certain targets, which I don't remember exactly how many we set ourselves to achieve. And that's it. I think that summarizes the work that we have done in the third quarter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, well, given that I'm rushing for another meeting, if I see no hands, let me jump in. Because I really have to get off now. Thanks very much, Chair, for that. You find lengthy, I must say, just for a quarter. And we're not finished. We still have to do the financing. But to me, the relocation of the department to the old land bank building is encouraging. I trust the old land bank building is being renovated before it goes in. We don't want to take things for granted. You know, sometimes you just take things for granted or to find that you can't. There was a story that, Chair, the moment you open the door, the lock or the handle fell off. But I wanted to raise the issue of provincial offices. I know this is a quarterly report. And please, when you come again, let's hear about the quarter, the provincial offices. Regarding the signed agreement, out of interest, where are they now? Are they on the way for them to be presented here? Or I know there are different types of agreements. Some are internal, they can be kept within the department, but some are for ratification here in Parliament. But to me, even if honorable members' agreements are just for internal, you know, custody by the department, it would be helpful if there's any confidential information that may be shared with us. The bullet point below that says that the agreements cover 1, 2, 3, they are helpful but they're not helpful at the same time. It would be helpful just to have a sense. Please share with us the queries that come from the presidential hotline that would help to see what kind of problems people do present to the hotline.
The ease of the regulatory account system, we already referred to a briefing. The same would happen with biofuels down the line. That will make Honorable Ross smile. Coming to hydrocarbons, there's a storage and distribution stock infrastructure gap analysis report. Unless I missed it, I didn't pick up where is that, because also that would be helpful to get our hands on. Or is that part of the, is that going to be part of the refinery audit? See, this is a very interesting area. If I can just go a little bit at length, we're going to have a revised strategy on security of strategic stocks. We're going to have a refinery audit, which I understand is going to be a very, or will conclude by the end of the year, the refinery audit. But then there is this also analysis report on storage. Let me be, clear. If it's a separate document, where is it? Because we would be keen to have an exposure on that. With regard to the Petroleum Products Amendment Bill, you know, what reminds me, what Mr. Kiza raised, is how DTI handled the Companies Act. At some stage, when there were urgent things to be addressed to the Companies Act, what they did was to bring to Parliament a couple of proposals for just a few amendments. But that was part of the overall drive to turn around the Companies Act. I'm just provoking that if it wouldn't be also appropriate to look at it in that way, because if you're not going to handle the bill as a whole, are you just shifting the problem to a later date? Because also I remember around the Petroleum Products Amendment, there were a couple of things really that I know really needed urgent attention. Which were warranting for the current act to be amended. With regards to educating the public on licensing, am I assuming correctly that the target audience or beneficiaries are mainly the retailers and the wholesalers? I trust and hope when it comes with the electricity distribution infrastructure, also honourable members, that you just be aware that we still owe you, as chairs, when we did that joint session, a follow up. I hope in the next 2 weeks we can have a lunch, work out a strategy, and come back to you as to how we're going to handle that. Also, reinforcing what the department is doing. You know, in view of all the presentations that were done there. Energy efficiency. Yes, I remember we did get an indication from the department that they were going to conclude the campaign strategy by end of last year. But if I remember well, we did indicate we look forward getting that report or the strategy. But in any case, just to indicate, we are looking around June, if I'm not June, to actually dwell very much on energy efficiency. So we'd be very, very keen to ensure that all these four pillars that and Pane has indicated will be part of that. The campaign strategy, the accord, the regulations,
and tax incentives and the conservation scheme. Anything that's been worked out, because they have to attach a lot of importance on energy efficiency. The last point is in terms of the booklet on the transport sector, CDM, which is amongst other things linked to renewable energy, linked to climate change issues. It would be helpful to share a couple of copies of that for us. Because also, when there's another gap, as energy, we are part of the climate change community. So we'd be very keen to have a sense of how far is the department advancing on the green development mechanism. Just another thing, one of the members, can we ensure when we get reports on quarterly performances in future that we get a comparative presentation to say this is how far we've gone in this quarter compared to what we're supposed to do. We've met our target, or we may have done 90-95% of our target, or we've gone beyond our target, because that's also possible, Mamuzo. It's not about just doing 80-90% of your target. You can also do 110% of your target. It's very possible. So it would be helpful to structure the reports in that way in future, particularly quarter reports. Honourable members, any further questions or inputs? Honourable Freling, Honourable Smala, Honourable Khadere, and Honourable Nott.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, there we go. Okay. You mentioned SARI and the accord that was signed last year, which I attended in Durban, and it's a great initiative. But what progress has taken place since then? Because from what I hear, a lot of these countries that have signed the MOU are very keen to get moving on it, and I'd be interested to hear whether South Africa has actually taken advantage of this MOU and what the progress is. So can you give us some sense of where we are sitting with that particular program? Then just going forward, in terms of the hydrocarbons and energy planning, when we, the development of regulations and liquefied petroleum gas pricing and LPG licensing framework, I'd just be interested to know where we are with LPG, because I've had a number of emails from very concerned LPG suppliers, particularly in the Western Cape, that are worried that with the kind of maintenance that will probably take place with refineries, that there's going to be a gas shortage again. So what are we doing in terms of security of supply with regards to LPG? Because it's of major concern. Because every time we have a shortage, it really sets us back in terms of getting LPG rolled out to households, and that people then lose faith in the technology. So what are we doing to secure this particular? I, in fact, tried to go buy gas yesterday, and I was told that there's no more gas at the places where I went. So it's a real problem, and it's starting to really bite at this point in time. Let me just see. Then just in terms of the National Nuclear Energy Executive Coordinating Committee, I mean, we've heard about the establishment of this team from the Deputy President, and I think he heads it. But where are we sitting with regards to this team? Have they met? What is their progress? Where are they in the particular system? Because the Deputy President did promise that this would be a very transparent process and he would keep us up to date with what's actually happening there. So where are we in terms of this particular process right now, if you can report on that? And then just lastly, the solar park initiative. Now, this is of great concern to me because this was announced with great fanfare, I think it was about a year and a half ago, and the minister at the time said we're going to get 5,000 megawatts from the solar park, even though I questioned, because it wasn't even in the IRP that we were going to get 5,000 megawatts at that stage from solar. And so it seemed to have been done in a very rushed job. It seemed to have been done because the Clinton Foundation wanted to announce some big initiative. And now it looks like we're only doing the feasibility study on the solar park initiative. And there's question marks over whether 5,000 megawatts can, in fact, be gotten from this. So Where are we sitting with the solar park initiative? Because it also pushed out a lot of uncertainty into the market around what our intentions are around there. I've heard that you now talk about solar corridors as opposed to a solar park itself. Where are we sitting with regards to this? Because I'd be interested to know. We need to get moving on that. Thank you.
I was raising my hand behind you.
No. Okay, Honorable Slawi.
Sir, I would not put more questions to the COO, save to say that I'm interested in the composition of the men's forum, and what criteria do you use to become a representative of men in that forum? What issues are getting discussed there? Just an idea of whether this men's forum is something that will work or not. I'm doubtful. Coming to the hydrocarbons, as you were presenting, Mr. Mkhize, I was asking myself what returns mean in this instance. Do they mean profit? Or is it returns in terms of your ability to put in and get back what you put in? Maybe just it's just a clarity question. It's not a problem. And the pricing of blends, I wrote something on the pricing of blends. That's this mixing, blending of fuel, using ethanol and so on. How do you anticipate it? Is it looking towards saving the current cost or worsening the current cost of petrol? In other words, this exercise of mixing, is it not going to add more to the price of petrol? You know, it's a fear. It's a fear. It's also not a genuine thing that I can say I know it has done it at such and such a place. But we already feeling the price of petrol as a motorist, and would not want to engage in a system that would make it worse. The energy cooperatives. DTI is currently dealing with a bill on cooperatives. And that bill is looking, debates are going to be raised around what do we want to interpret a cooperative to be in the South African model. Whether a few people can get together, form some kind of company in a partnership manner, and we call that a cooperative. They get funding from somewhere, then it becomes a cooperative. Or whether we want to identify a particular industry and say we start from beginning to the end, and the people around that particular thing, like say for instance in agriculture, starting from plowing and breeding and growing the animals, but plowing the seeds and growing the crops up to harvesting and selling into the market. That particular thing. And then land is identified in a bigger scale. And that particular project all over the show has got shareholders, and those shareholders are what you can call cooperative, agricultural cooperative, the sectoral kinds of cooperative as opposed to business cooperative. Maybe a discussion would be necessary between the two departments in this regard to look at what would be the best model for South Africa in regards to cooperatives. The current act is problematic in addressing that particular issue. On the infrastructure, One realizes, you know, as the presentations were going, that there's a lot of documents that Honorable Chairperson, as members, we are not aware of. There is a lot of information that moves around on energy, and you have mentioned this in the past. Some of it comes, of course, from universities and other interest areas into the particular endeavors, and they spread from there. But others come directly from the department to the public, which we do not even know. And we get reports here that would say, we have completed this process of public consultation in such and such a period. But we don't even know what the content of that document is that people were consulted on. What is going to happen when we go to consultation? We would not be able to compare the consultation by the department with our own consultation. That maybe we should find a way through which we can be able to share information. We do not want to debate information that you are still consulting on in order to formulate a final document. We cannot debate that still proposal at the stage. It will officially come to us after it has gone through cabinet and it has been assented to. But at least just to know that there is this particular development that is going on around within us. Then we can also be applying our minds as other people are applying their minds on the same document without using the official structure to veto it, you know, to say yes or no. Still on the hydrocarbons, no. That part that I have passed. On the issue of the infrastructure overall, the infrastructure in this particular sector of the industry, the energy industry, there is a process that is unfolding to deal with that. Is it possible for us to know the overall picture? The overall picture that says in the hydrocarbons, this is the extent of damage on the infrastructure and the extent of expense and work that needs to be done. So that we can be able to measure, when you say you have done this, we measure it against your target or against the established target of what ultimately could be achieved. And the same could happen also, I think, on the electricity, to know the extent to which there is need for rehabilitation of the old infrastructure on the one hand, but the extent to which, as a result of lack of infrastructure totally, we still need to work towards achieving, what do you call that 100% by chief? When we have achieved 100% electrified universal access. So that we know the overall and we can be able to look at development and progress leading towards a particular overall picture. This question I have already asked because it also appears in another slide. On the issues relating to electricity, nuclear, and clean energy, I'm not sure if we really mean to achieve a million by 2014 if we are not as yet even into a 10,000 or a 100,000. 2014 is just tomorrow. And according to this connection we have, $43,000 and $13,000 and $5,000 altogether can be at around $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. We still very far. I think we need to put in some more more emphasis on the need to push this project. But we are not also hearing more about how much this project uses local content, whether the processes of establishing companies that can manufacture or that can do the solar water heaters from locals are there, whether we're making progress in that particular thing. And the other question is the rural area, that it looks like just starting from the president's speech, and now I'm getting it through the department, it looks like we are beginning to concentrate back into the urban areas and forget about the rural areas. One matter, which is the last question, that is much worrying, is how much we have been speaking about cleaner energy, energy efficiency, and how much we've been speaking about leading by example. And up to so far, Chairperson, I'm even of the opinion that maybe we need just a committee to organize publicity activity about how much we are not doing what we should be doing. The houses of both ministers and parliamentarians, which are belonging to public works, the parliament buildings, the union buildings, and all other offices of government are not energy efficient. I have not seen one solar around in this building. You can't even talk about it in union buildings. Those things are not happening. But we are the people that must drive the entire nation to go that route. Thanks, Chair.
Honourable Lord, can you please come and take me? Can I bow up, please? Chair, does that mean the chairperson has absorbed his question?
Unfortunately not, but there are just other pressure. Apologies, really apologies.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start from the beginning, and I would like to understand your operational costs towards the new building, towards land bank. Is it effectively budgeted for that there are no concerns, you know, in the movement and running, you know, taking over the office, that there might be some complications towards maybe transfer of ITs and, you know, those technology systems, so that there's not a vacuum that takes place? Your staff complement that was approved, you referred to 900. Is that linked to a budget? And I did not understood that you said that the IPP unit, when it comes into effect, it actually declines. And I just needed to understand that a little bit better. If you can just elaborate on that. Your RAS margin module, when we're talking about the ring fencing of the tax break of the financing within that module, I would presume that when it's ring fenced, it will go back into that specific sector rehabilitate that specific sector. Is that how I understand it? Once certain monies has been ring fenced, you know, on the pipeline within the monies, when you said there are certain things that are ring fenced, because I haven't read, I haven't been exposed towards that document. So when you talk about ring fencing, the specific financing of that module, so that there's no cross-subsidizing happening. I just needed to understand the breakdown and where that money actually then goes back to if we do ring fence. The going to biofuels and mixing and mixing the different blends, how does that impact our future plans into cleaner energy fuels? Does that have negatively impact on how our multi industry and our manufacturing side actually want to see us moving into cleaner energy fuels? Because I do want to understand if does that actually weaken the quality of the actual fuel components that we are actually then giving out to the consumers. On your IECs, your integrated energy centers. When I listen to the problems that you experience, I wonder if the planning is how the planning is actually happening. Are you planning to let it be self-sufficient eventually, or how long do you sustain it in some sort of assistance, and in what way would you like to step away so that your role is completed, and maybe your role beforehand, how that part of the community is actually involved, so that by the time of handing over, they can actually do it. Okay, that the chair has asked. How many your site inspections? How many sites do you need to inspect? How many sites are there? Because you've done 411. I'm trying to understand, is there a backlog, is there not a backlog, to how many people, to what is the content of people that we actually service to, what is our outreach towards those quality checks. Is our regional offices involved in these checks, or is it actually done on a national point? The changing of the including of the block tariff systems, which Eskom has changed the prepaid systems, and your focus now on the metros and later on the smaller local municipalities. What is the actual effect that has got on the consumer? Is there abnormality that are taking place? Are the people that are being serviced by Eskom being are they benefiting above what we are, you know, what the municipalities are, you know? I'm just trying to understand, is there a difference between the two? The disposal unit of nuclear energy, which is your Schedule 3A company, which will take place maybe only in a year's time. What is currently the case with disposal of nuclear energy? Where does the risk lie now, with regard to that?
Thanks.
Thank you, Chef.
Thank you. I've got just a few questions. I'm trying not to repeat, you know, some of the questions that has been asked, because I've noticed that Lotto wanted to finish the whole paper, so
what's the lot?
No, I just want to get a clarity here that the 16 water heaters that you said they were installed during the 16 days of activism were in ML or Crisis Mir, because I need to get a clarity between the you know, because ML is a town and the 16 days of activism was in Crisis Mir. So one need to get to, you know, understand that aspect, because we need to ensure that I'm sure that's one of my constituents, so I must be able to be aware so that I can also go and check what is the response of the people that will receive it and what is happening, because it's one of the things that you must be able to, you know, keep in check with. Check. I just want to check in terms of the IECs. That's what is the state of the IEC at the moment? How many do we have? Because last when we were doing an oversight, we discovered that some of them, you know, they were not functioning. Some of them they were supposed to be have implemented long time, but there was a challenge in terms of, you know, the proper implementation of those IECs. And the other question relates to what is the plan to spread the IECs all over the province, the provinces, all over the country, basically. Because I've noticed that some of the IECs are now concentrated in one area. Some of the other areas, you know, they don't have those IECs. When you go and check the also the well, let me just ask this out of a question. The issue of the function of the IECs relation to the cooperatives. Last time there was a challenge, and there was an improvision made by, you know, some of the regional offices of your department. I want to check whether are you still improvising while you're still waiting for the legislation to take place, or what is happening? Because one needs to be aware of what is happening with the proper functioning of the IECs. The other thing, Babumkis, I want to know in terms of those the 411 sites that you've inspected, whether do they include most of the inland site or is the coastal site? If one can be able to be aware of those, because well, Chair, last time I couldn't probably, maybe I've missed the answer. That what is the future plan of the department in terms of the maintenance of the solar water, you know, geysers, because I'll want to know, because once you install something and you don't have maintenance plan, they're going to be dilapidated and it will be a waste of the money of the government. I can't remember whether I got the answer, but I still want to, you know, get a response around that one. Last one, Chair. The transport sector booklet. I just had
Babu Apan is saying is finalized. I know he hears me, although he couldn't listen carefully. I want to know, where is the document? I haven't seen it. Is it possible that we can get it as a department? I mean, as a portfolio committee, so that at least we can be able to be familiar with the document. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I've got a question about the training of your staff members. I just want to know, because there's always a cry that the department are training people and those people are taken by the private sector. Do you have that problem as well? And if you do, are you ever aware that some of these people taken by the private sector are being redundant in their workplaces with all the qualifications that they have? The other one is about the training of women that have gone abroad. But what worries me is that there are no funds, and those people are from the rural areas. So does it really make sense to train people and not assist them to can do something, especially being women, so that those other women can be encouraged and also try to come closer? I think the other one that Mr. Mkhize spoke about is the legislation, I mean the policy. I think with the pricing, and you're still waiting for the cabinet to meet, but I think that is very good, but the waiting part of it, especially when we are going to the increment of fuel, paraffin, and so forth. These poor people, the very poor people who are paraffin users, are really suffering, because once paraffin goes up, I mean petrol goes up, paraffin also goes up. Can't we really have a real look into that, so that people won't say that we are really exploiting? Thank you, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Ross and Martin, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Chair. I'll be guided by the wisdom of the answers today. I don't want to repeat something that I perhaps have spoken of. The questions were about the biofuels, and I think Honorable Freyland has spoken about these, Chair, so I'll just be guided by the answers.
Thank you. Martin, do anything?
No, thank you, Chair. I don't have questions. I think they've got enough questions for the afternoon as well.
Okay, thank you. Just quick ones from my side, two quick ones. On the refinery audit, I just want to establish, after you have secured these results from the audit, what key decisions, specific decisions, would this audit enable you to take? And the last one is on the Office of the Controller, of the Petroleum Controller. Given that you'll be bringing a new legislation, Electricity Regulation Act, Amendment Act, is there a way that this office will be impacted by that legislation, or will it remain distinct? Some ideas that were presented during that hearing, the initial briefing, that would want NERSA at one stage to regulate the whole value chain. Would this office be impacted by those type of developments? Thank you. Over to you. Let's keep it short, because we are going for another presentation. You have got a new chairperson. By half past 12, we should be out for it.
Thank you, new chairperson and honorable members. I'll just take care of some of the questions, and then my colleagues will quickly go through the more technical questions. On the issue of the relocation in terms of our regional offices, Yes, it is a concern for us as a department, and we are working on that. But currently, the regional offices were still housed by the DMR, because they are the ones who have signed the contract with the landlords. But we are frantically working on getting most of our offices out of that environment. In terms of the agreements or the MOUs that have been signed, the chairperson asked for, or the previous chairperson, asked for some information with regards to those agreements. What I want to suggest that you would do, last week we received a letter from the Speaker of Parliament, if I'm not mistaken, requesting all government departments to fill in a table of all the agreements that they've, and the financial implication of all the agreements that they've entered into. I think what we'll do, once that exercise is complete, we'll forward a copy to the Secretariat and can distribute it to the members as well. Sharing of queries that you receive from the hotline, that can be arranged. I'll advise my colleague from communications to get a report over to the Secretariat probably next week, because most of us are out of the office this week, if you can bear with us, to get that kind of information. Then going forward, then, as and when this happens, they can either give you a quarterly report or a monthly report, depending on how many queries. Well, we don't have that many, to be honest. So as and when they happen, then we can work out how soon we can get the information over to the committee. We will consider the suggestion from the previous chairperson on the tabulating of the presentations on the performance information in our next performance report that we're doing for the end of the year. Coming back to Honourable Crayling's question on SARI. SARI was originally, I would ask Mr. Apane when he does his response as well, if I've left out something to add on that. But SARI was originally within the DTI. So what has happened since the signing in November? DTI has written to our minister to say that they're heading over that function to the department. So it's officially now within the Department of Energy. DTI has also committed to say they are prepared to support us financially, because as a Department of Energy, we don't have the funding for a period of not exceeding 6 months for the setting up of the Secretariat within the Department of Energy. So we are working with DTI on that. We do have a steering committee which comprises of DTI, the Department of Energy, I think National Treasury. So not 100% sure, it could be. That are actually the steering committee on the project. We are the lead there. So the responsibility is with the department. Also, as a matter of interest, is that last week we had a meeting with the Swiss representative on the issue of SARI, and they are happy to say that, in fact, they've actually asked the department to come up with a proposal in terms of finding the secretariat on a long-term basis. So there's a lot of the things that we are working on at the moment as well. I think the steering committee will be meeting within the next week or so to work on that proposal for the Swiss. So there is a lot of work happening there. We are hoping that, or if actually recommended through a submission to the DG, that function probably be in the DG's office, and we try and have it as senior as possible, so that we can have an independent person be able to carry that forward with whatever support structure that individual will have. On the issue of the men's forum, unfortunately, I did not attend the men's forum, of course, because I am. It's one of those instances where I was not a man. But it has been presented to the department, say, by the different, by the current temporal leader, or the person who's currently responsible for it, as a report back at EXCO, and the DG has been very much interested in that going forward. So we're hoping that it's not going to falter in terms of that. But overall, it's, if I remember well, what was presented was they were saying that we have a situation where we don't, as institutions, I'm almost certain of that, we don't take care of the male element in our own institutions. We always say we've got women programs, got women that, which is fine. I'm not. I don't have a problem with that. However, we do work in an environment of males. Males have got responsibilities within the department, responsibilities outside the department, in homes, in their societies, those kinds of things.
and what impact does that do to them, which in unfortunately some of the cases it comes out in how they behave in a work environment. So it's those kinds of discussions that men are supposed to be taking among themselves to say that what affects me outside and how do I respond to it when it comes back into your work environment. Also, it's sort of a platform for them to come together like we do. I mean, it was a men thing, that was not me. Like women do, we sit together and we talk about those things. Well, it's not every woman who likes talking about her things. It's not every man who likes to talk about her things, his things. Anyway, his private life. So it's providing a platform for those who would like to be part of a wider group to share the challenges that they have, to share their own advancement within a working environment. Because it's not automatic that just whether a man is going to get promoted or a woman. There will be instances like that happening, but it's not, you can't take it for granted. So those are some of the challenges that what they are saying, that men experience as much challenges as women do, be it in work environment, be it private life, be it in societies. So how do they deal with them as men? But the most important one, of course, is how they treat us, the women of the Department of Energy, because we are very precious individuals. But that was the gist of the discussion. with regard to the circulation of DOE publications, I've heard the outcry in terms of accessibility of this information. Well, some of it will be on our website. I'm not 100% sure whether everything is on the website, so I will hand that over as well when I go back to our communications chief director to make sure that if there are documents, important documents that have been sent out by the department, that we have a way of saying that when people are coming down here to come to the committee, they bring a couple of copies for distribution to the committee, whatever we have in stock at the moment, and then we'll work on how we do that going forward. This question, unfortunately, the previous chair did not introduce most of the members. I didn't get the honourable member's name. Sorry? Smal. Okay. Honourable Smal, you asked us something on the staff complement, the 44. What I was saying is that number consists of the IPP unit, which is the unit, is the newly created unit in the department which is responsible for running the independent power producers program. So we've added it to the number of vacancies because it's part of our structure, but it's been newly introduced in the department. So what we did, we received the money from Treasury towards the end of last year to say that, I think it was about 3 million formula. It was about 3 million for the payroll, and then the balance was supposed to be for other administrative costs. So that amount had to be used, coming back to your comment earlier, it had to be ring-fenced for the IPP unit personnel. So while we're advertising those posts, that number is sitting in our books as vacancies. So it doesn't have much to do with the overall 566 at the moment, because that number, it includes what the department has outside the IPP environment. And on the issue of the solar panels, Honourable Khadeb, I'm going to have to come back to you on that one, because all I know is that they went to MLO. Exactly where, I have to find out the full information regarding that. We'll come back to you as soon as we can. We'll send it out to the secretariat. Thank you, sir. I will leave the rest to my colleagues, starting with the CFO on my right.
Thank you. The operational cost for the move to the land bank building, the operational cost, that's the rental, has been covered within the normal operational budget, that's the MGF allocation. The equipment, there was a question around the equipment, the IT equipment, that is CapEx. So the capital expenditure for the move has not been budgeted for. But the IT equipment, it's going to be new infrastructure. But the existing equipment that's used in the current Trevena campus, what can be reused will be transferred to the new building, I think. And then there was another question. The current building.
And then the ring fencing question on the petroleum pipeline, 2012-13 financial year will be the last. It was $4.5 billion over 3 years. 2012-13 will be the final tranche of $1.5 billion. And that is ring fenced money. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just respond now to the questions that pertain to hydrocarbons and energy planning branch. Firstly, there was a question that was posed by the chairperson to say that there is this issue of storage and distribution infrastructure. We do have kind of a database that is in constant development, and we're trying to also link up with the NERSA so that as they get applications for whether it's depot, whatever infrastructure, they then were able to get that information also flowing to us for the same infrastructure. There are big items like the NMTP, the Durban to Johannesburg pipeline, all that, all of that comprises the infrastructure in the country. And we are having that database and wanting to keep updating the infrastructure database. The 20-year liquid fuels infrastructure roadmap will also provide a better insight in terms of the capacity that we need. Because one of the things that the 20-year liquid fuels infrastructure roadmap should do will be to indicate to us the kind of infrastructure that we need going forward so that we can be able to meet our energy demand in the long term, the medium to long term. So that will also encompass the whole issue of infrastructure. The other thing that we have is that the PPAA, the Petroleum Products Amendment Act, we note what the PTI has done, and we will look into that and have an engagement with them as part of improving our PPA from our side, the Petroleum Products Amendment Act. And then there was also a question around the educating the public on the PPA and licensing to say who the target audience were, assuming that they were retailers or wholesalers. They are indeed the prospective retailers and wholesalers, as well as people that want to move into the biofuels manufacturing field or even conventional fuel manufacturing area. Then there was another question on LP gas shortage. What are we doing to improve security of supply? We still need to engage with the Transnet pipeline. We tried last month to get hold of them, but we should have this session very soon in terms of looking, because there are a lot of things that are overlapping, because even the oil companies have raised issues around the leasing of import infrastructure, etc. So we want to meet with them. As I indicated earlier on, that last year we had a visit to the Transnet Port Authority, and we came over here in Cape Town, also in Devon, and we briefed on what is happening on Sardana. We are busy at the moment trying to close the whole issue of the MRTP, the maximum refinery gate price, an issue that we talk to the importation of LPG, because the refineries are really tailored towards the production of liquid fuel as other than just LPG. And we tried, like last year, PetroSA did try to assist, but in the process they incurred a loss because they had to take molecules that would normally go to petrol and put them into LPG, which is not sustainable in the form that it is being done.
So we'd have to look at the issue of importation. It's mainly all around importation and heavy goods import facilities and being able to compensate accordingly for the import. Because it's unfortunately going to come at a price. So this is what we finalized. We would have done this thing now had the person that is responsible for this process within the department been not having problems and unavailable to ill health and other issues that have impacted on this individual, but we'll be able to put conclusion to this matter soon in terms of the MRGP to at least publish it and have and start the process of reviewing it. The internal documents have already been done. And then on the issue of other thing, on the men's forum, I know that they've requested us to submit representatives that will also assist the individual department to be able to put forth men's issues. And then on the pricing of plans, whether will it be saving or adding more to the price of petrol? The pricing of plans is actually in line with promoting, cleaner fuels. I'll just answer those the other issues, whether it's doing good or not. It's in line with promoting cleaner fuels because, as we know, that diesel comes from crude oil, which is which contributes more in terms of CO2 emissions, etc. Vis a vis getting it from plant material or vegetable matter, which would be the biodiesel or the bioethanol. So in that instance, it got a positive contribution. We want the oil companies that are going to be buying these biofuels to remain cost neutral. That is the issue here, to find ways of getting cost neutral, which will talk to the issues whether do we have subsidize or not, because it's got a positive contribution to the economy. So that is how we're looking in terms of biofuels. So the plans themselves, I would say that they could be instances where, in way of assisting the biofuel manufacturers, it comes at a bit of a higher price. But there would be instances where the price of petrol itself is very high, so that when the blends come in, it comes in as a saving or it leaves us neutral. So it's the issue of cost neutrality to the producer of conventional fuel. Then the returns that you talk about, the returns are normally whether it's a 15% return or whatever return, but that we needed to have a scientific calculation of that return, what kind of profit of markup, in other words, the return that these people should be getting. With the energy cooperatives, we are working very closely with the DTI already. Unfortunately, last week I had to come down here to Cape Town, but there was a meeting that was scheduled also for the DTI unit that is responsible coming from the registrar of cooperatives and companies that came to the department to present the different ownership model that can assist in terms of ensuring continuity. Because we don't want to forever babysit these cooperatives. We want to be able to establish them, get them trained, and walk away. But because of the development and challenges that people experience, we always have got to come back and assist. And it is true, like what has been said, that IEC, we do establish them, but we find that there are problems in terms of operational problems that they experience, and we step in to assist. For example, there are two municipalities where they've got cash flow problems now, and we're asking also the municipality to come and assist so that there can be some cash injection, get them to run, make a profit, and be able to then sustain. So we do have them, like Eshane Municipality in KZN. There's been some problems there, but we are trying to resolve them. Some of them, they become political in nature because the municipality is this and the mayor is this and not coming in. But all those things, as raised when during the KZN visit, we are trying to address them. The IECs are in all provinces, or supposed to be in all provinces, although, for example, I know that in Mpumalanga, in that area, has not been addressed. But currently, Sasol is working together with us to try to establish another one. In the Mpopo, there is
one or two in Nwabe, and we are trying to also to establish one in Khalakhad, is on the northwest. Yeah, but we are, there are ISIS there. And in January, there was a visit to Northern Cape, also for the team to talk to the municipalities, the local government, to looking at the establishment. We take the partnership between local government and ourselves, as well as the oil companies, to establish these ISIS. The new companies that we have also been able to bring new companies on board, like Shell, they want to establish one. We want to establish one in the Popo. We also brought along Engen. Engen also want to establish, and we said to them, we can have a situation where they just do a pilot in terms of the ownership structure and not necessarily follow cooperatives, as long as the benefit is going to accrue also to the community. Then I think I've already spoken to the issue of infrastructure. In terms of the damage done, it which would be just for us to give the status, but the investment also need to flow both from our side and from the private sector, because there is a backbone infrastructure which will then enable private sector to invest. So in terms of that infrastructure, the one of the key things that the 20-year liquid food infrastructure is going to help us with is to take key decisions. For example, there's a key decision around refining, refining capacity, what capacity do we need, at what time as we go forward in the future, and of what nature. For example, do we have 200,000 barrels per day, do we have 400,000 barrels per day, to cut that in chunks and see how it fits in terms of the pipeline as well. It will also talk to the issue of ports, because if you build, even if you build a guha, you will still need infrastructure at the port to take it to coastal shipping from guha to Durban and put it into the NMPP for some time and let it go to Gauteng. So those things will come in. And then the other question from one of us more was I think the biofuels. I think I've already spoken to the issue that they will assist the cleaner fuels. As I look at last year through my presentation, I said, for example, if you've got low sulfur diesel, that sulfur has got this problem, but if you've got low sulfur diesel, you lose on lubricity. And when you put biodiesel, it helps in terms of improving the lubricity, making it flow easier. So that there are those contributions from biofuels. And on the site inspection, the regional offices are the ones that are actually involved, because the inspectors, there's one inspector for each region, and these inspectors are in the region and they do inspection for sites in that particular region. Looking at our financial situation, etc., the funding, etc., we had 375 being the target, and I think we did better than that. But we still want to do more in terms of the quality of the inspection, like being able to take samples, analyze those samples. Sometimes we need to be sure that the specifications are met as outlined in the standard at all times. Then the other issue was, I think the ring fencing has been dealt with, but when it comes to the regulatory accounting system matching module, is that the ring fencing is to say, if you've got petrol being regulated at a set price at retail level, and diesel being not regulated at retail level, you don't want a situation where you are paying for diesel and there is cross subsidization. It has to ring fence the activity to say when they get some compensation, that compensation is based on petrol and not funding diesel in a way that is camouflaged. On legislation on the illuminating paraffin, we have already going ahead with this process, and for me, I see it as part of the improvement of the current system, where just an increase just means an automatic increase in the price of the retailer in the markup. So it is going to have a process that anyway we've got just to go through it now and finalize. With regard to the office of the controller from the chairperson now, the office of the controller is not necessarily impacted by the electricity regulation amendment as such. But what is it does not impact it, but it's impacted there by the NERSA Amendment Act, in the sense that even right from the beginning, there was thinking that all these regulatory aspects, especially licensing, will be housed in the Department of Energy as a transition, and then later on moved to NERSA. So this will be in line with that in terms of that whole unit. There is a chance that it be moved over. I think Pompey will help in that process. I think that's all from my side, and that's something that I've said.
Chair, Honorable Chair, if I can take the questions, the remaining questions, perhaps starting with the last one around NERSA regulating the whole value chain. I think that's correct. I think our Director General did indicate that there is a policy intention to consolidate all the regulatory aspects under that entity, NERSA, particularly those that are not within NERSA, that are housed outside of the department. And Chair, the law is written in a way that makes it possible, because NERSA has been established, and it's a question of amending perhaps the Gas Act and the petroleum pipelines side by side with the Electricity Act to make sure that everything falls within that NERSA ambit. Regarding the training of staff and poaching, yes, we do have a bit of a problem, but I think it's common with, I suppose, the space within which we work. It's a constrained skills space, and from time to time we do lose staff to industry. Our attitude is that they're not lost to South Africa. We're happy to service in South Africa. But we do have specific training program. In fact, it has become even more critical now that we have these big programs on renewable energy and so on. Fortunately, we do have agreements with different countries to collaborate, and we have the ability to send our staff to world-class training opportunities outside of our borders. If I can perhaps then move to the question around the progress with the South African Renewable Initiative. Yes, the agreements, undertakings were signed late last year at COP17. We have had interactions with three of the four countries that are keen to participate. In fact, only last week we had some conceptual agreement with the Swiss. And the project steering committee has been proposed, a number of dates have been proposed for the institution to take off. We see SARI in a different light slightly, because we're saying that SARI is in the main about reducing the capital cost associated with the renewable energy technologies in the main. Secondly, is that we want to localize those technologies, so there is the localization aspect, which is mainly a DGI mandate, and DGI will assist in that. So, sorry, in relation to the capital cost and the financing of renewable energy programs, it would be the Department of Finance or National Treasury. And then regarding meeting our energy needs, would be the Department of Energy, in other words, the IRP and the introduction of renewable energy technologies into the mix. So that is underway, and we believe that we've made some progress towards the implementation of the SARI concept. An
NPC has not met yet. That's the Nuclear Decision Making Authority. Cabinet only approved, I think it was the last cabinet meeting of last year that this was institutionalized. There has been a lot of technical work. We have some 5 or 6 meetings have already been held at the technical level, the interdepartmental team, and the Director General, our Director General, who chairs the what we call the Nuclear Energy Technical Committee, the NETC, has called for a meeting this month. So there should be some approach to the NNEC regarding certain decisions in the course of this month.
This is in the department,
yeah. It's the same departments that are led by their ministers in the NNEC. Department of Energy, Finance, EPE, Department of Trade and Industry, Science and Technology, Economic Development, Water, one of them is represented by the, and then we also have an arrangement in terms of which we bring in the technical specialist work. So for example, we've had an assessment around the risks of a nuclear build program, construction risks. There's also the financing aspects of it in terms of which we've got some experts to get a sense of what the models are. Over and above government, from time to time, we would bring in the working groups, depending on the subject matter. The intention, if I can also indicate, is that we would approach it. I'm sure you might be familiar with the workings of the IMC around the energy, the Interministerial Committee around the energy, where there would be different working groups, like regulatory, financing, risk, tariff. Citing and so on and so forth, transaction advice. So that's the intention, but the Director General's meeting will clarify all of those within this month. Then regarding the solar park, firstly to indicate that in the IRP there is provision enough megawatts to include the solar park. It's just not called the solar park, but the IRP has already made provision for enough megawatts to facilitate the introduction of the solar park concept. In fact, this past week there has been a decision that was made at the government level, the technical level, to recommend to our principals that in fact the approach that we used for the renewable energy IPP program needs to be adapted a little bit, particularly because at the moment we are, if I can call it, project takers. So in other words, government is not in a position at this point to control the location of projects. And what this does is that then we react by taking the transmission and distribution infrastructure to those areas to evacuate the power. And this makes for very haphazard planning, whereas the approach that the solar park philosophy follows is one where we prescribe, we designate certain areas as being most suitable from a resource perspective, from a grid perspective, but also from a local economic development perspective. And that approach you will see more and more in the next approach towards developing IPP. Renewable energy IPP, and that is consistent with the solar park concept. In terms of the feasibility itself, is that the pre-feasibility has demonstrated, based on certain criteria, that this could be very feasible for South Africa, particularly in the Northern Cape. And around the feasibility itself would have been the detail now as to the timing of those projects, grid infrastructure requirements, the support infrastructure requirements, etc., etc. And Chair, without going into the detail, because it's a little bit too complicated, it's got the social, political, and also financial dimensions, is that we have not been able to advance the feasibility study to that level of detail around land availability. So we know that the pre-feasibility has confirmed that that particular area or those areas, the three areas that were initially earmarked for the solar park concept, are very feasible. They don't have fatal flaws, but just in terms of going through the necessary processes to secure the land, and it's mainly because the land is owned by a different sphere of government, but also to go through a process that ultimately gives national government the necessary wherewithal to implement the project. It stems from the constitutional arrangements around land ownership, transfer, and so on. So I'm saying that we can give you some details, but those are some of the issues that we have come across in terms of accessing the land. And that's very critical for a feasibility study that would ultimately then kickstart the solar park concept. In terms of its resolution, Chair, we think that within the next few months, because there is a plan B and a plan C, we will be able to take off. It does not mean that we don't have the solar park concept as such. We'll be approaching the cabinet, and then we'll be able to elaborate a little bit more. Then regarding solar water heating, whether we will achieve the 1 million target and the risks associated with that, I think Honorable Slau interprets the numbers on a different basis, because to get to 1 million, it's a cumulative basis, so you have to add everything together. What we're saying is that in the period under review, we're only adding whatever those numbers were, 4,000 and we're only adding, for example, on electrification, 43,000 connections, and then on the municipalities, 13,000. That's only 50,000. Yet, cumulatively, we will easily reach 180,000. You don't see what we have done in quarter one, two, and three. So it's just a snapshot around the window. So don't get worried by the 729,000, 47,000 solar water heating. To date, as I indicated, we have done 220,000 connections. So if you add everything up cumulatively, then you'll get to that number. But I guess the question around coverage and whether rural areas are being left out is the one that we need to deal with. And Chair, with the allocation of the additional 4.7 billion rands, you will see a lot more rural and RDP low-cost coverage than we will see on the other side. It's a good thing, but it's also worrisome for the reasons that we have found at the last presentation of the briefing that we made here, because it will meet one aspect of the set of objectives, which is the fact that it's universal access, it will stimulate local economic development, but unfortunately it will not save the amount of electricity and the amount of tonnage of CO2 emissions as contemplated. And therefore, there is a complementary program that will then target the high segment of the market to close the loop, so to speak. Regarding maintenance, Chair, I think we did go to some detail at the last briefing that we had flagged the risk around the 220,000 systems that have been installed already, insofar as the risk relates to maintenance arrangements. And Chair, one of the corrective measures that have been introduced is that we have changed the delivery model. So in the contracting model that ESCOM will be implementing moving forward, is that necessarily there will be a maintenance contract so that there is a function to go behind ESCOM's installation program to maintain those systems that have already been installed over and above the guarantee that we've provided in there. In the other program, the standard offer program, it is inherent that you would only get your your operational subsidy as long as the system works. And necessarily, if you don't maintain it, the system does not work, you know, the risks are managed in that way by stopping your subsidies. The question around leading by example and so on, Chair, I think we are equally guilty there as government from a retrofitting of government buildings perspective. I think about 5-7 years ago, we did retrofit Parliament and the Union buildings and so on, but there's some 140,000 government buildings where I'm not so sure if one could look at the lighting and confirm that it's energy efficient. So we welcome that comment. Then IBT, inclining block tariffs and what the effect is on the consumer. Just to go back, inclining block tariffs are meant to cushion the poor against steep electricity tariff increases. And how this is done is that if you go back to 2009, when the regulator made the last tariff determination for last Friday, was that for a ban, in other words, for those that are consuming free basic electricity, which is between 0 and 50 kilowatt hours, the first 50 kilowatt hours would actually not be subjected to a tariff increase. In fact, there was a decline in the tariff. Right? So on average, the tariff increase was 25%, but for those that were between 0 and 50 kilowatt hours, the actual tariff increase was a decline, was a decrease. The next ban between 50 and, I think, 150 was a 3.5% tariff increase, if I remember the numbers correctly. So they would have been cushioned, they would have been insulated from the 25% increase. And then the last band up to, I think, 350 would have been a 60% increase. And everybody that consumes outside of that would have been charged a different tariff range. So that is the impact. The impact, firstly, is that those that are not consuming outside of those thresholds, and by extension, those that are poor customers would not be, should not worry about the electricity tariff increases. And the flag, if I can call it that, is then taken up through a cross subsidy by the key industrial customers, by those that consume a lot more. So it's the user pay principle that is being applied here. So that's the one side of the impact of of IBT. Incidentally, IBT, as I have just explained, with those blocks, right, that's why it's called an inclining block. Then the first block up to 50 would be a decline, the second block and so on. It could not be applied to prepaid meters because prepaid meters have a uniform charge, say so many rands per kilowatt hour charge. So you cannot talk of it an inclining block in that sense. So you needed to convert the prepaid technology, which covers some 8 million customers, in order to do that. Now, Eskom had completed that, but those municipalities that have prepaid meters, particularly the metros and some of the secondary cities, had struggled to convert the prepaid meters. And so I'm happy to confirm that we now have a database of progress on some of those municipalities that have now been able to convert their prepaid meters. But the program, we think, is going to take some time before all of the prepaid meters have been converted. So that is the benefit on the side. On the other side is that that which I call the slack, in other words, the revenue that is then not collected from these customers is transferred to the other the customers. And maybe to complete the loop is that we are worried that it cannot be an overload on those customers. So at the moment, we're in the middle of determining that tipping point where you start overloading the high-consuming customers beyond competitiveness, beyond affordability, and so on and so forth. So in time, we'll be able to present the proper cost-benefit analysis in relation to that. Trying to hurry up, Chair. National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute. My colleague took more time, Chair, so I'll have my time. The National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institute. Currently what happens is that some of these functions are undertaken by the different operator, right? So you have, for example, NERSA operating the LEU, the low enriched uranium disposal site in the Northern Cape, and you have ESCOM operating the high enriched, the spent fuel, if you like, which is high enriched uranium site at Quebec itself. So what we're doing is that we're saying that you can't have the operator also being responsible for executing the safeguards. So the National Radioactive Waste Disposal Institution will take care of that in a manner that is not impacted or affected by the operators. So it does not compromise the risk at the moment. All it does is that it stays, you know, as is until the disposal institution is able to take over. Then regarding the transport booklet, transport sector booklet that has been published, I think that's been answered. We can distribute a few of those. And then I've covered the issue around training, poaching, and also the NERSA issue regulating the data. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next presentation, the quarterly financial performance presentation. Over to you, Ms. Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, I'm going to cover the third quarter performance. I'll give an overview, and then I'll give the performance again by program, just highlighting some of the major variances, and then the budget composition for the next 3 years, that's the MTF period. And finally, I've put in a forecast report. I think lots of things have happened subsequent to December, and I think the members would want to know where we're going to finish off the financial year. So I will cover that briefly. Chair, for the 9 months ended, we had a budget of $4.9 billion. We spent $4.3 billion. We were left with $561 million, which is 70% of the budget has been spent. Under compensation of employees, we have a 2.1% overspend, and I'll go into the reasons as we go into the programs and in the overview. Goods and services, we had an underspend of 7.8%. Transfers and subsidies, we had an underspend of 11.8%, and I will unpack the reasons and the amounts here. Payments for capital assets, we are underspent by 53%. At the end of the third quarter, the department had disbursed a total of $4.37 billion, or 70% of the budget. The total disbursement of $4.37 billion was $561 million less than the available funds that could have been expended for that 9 months that ended. It was mainly due to the transfer payments that didn't happen as planned. Transfer payments, the department had a total of $4.7 billion available to transfer. $4.1 billion was transferred, resulting in a variance of $552 million as of December 2011. The underspending of the $552 million is mainly due to the following. Program 2, Energy Policy and Planning, that's the Transnet Pipeline, $370 million for December was not transferred. Program 3, Energy Regulation, working for the energy project, $17.5 million, it was less than budget. Energy Efficiency, Demand Side Management, transfer payments to municipalities, $61.8 million was not transferred. Program 4, the National Electrification Program, transfers to the municipalities, $88.7 million not transferred. But when I go to the programs, I'll give you the reasons thereof. Still part of the overview, goods and services. The results reflected within the goods and services economic classification showed a $9.1 million year-to-date underspend. This is mainly due to the underspending within professional services and the delay in the implementation of the energy modeling system. However, the saving will be redirected in other areas, and the year-to-date spending within goods and services of Program 2 is $7.5 million below budget, and these unspent funds have been redirected within the department. For the 9 months ended 31 December 2011, the major cost drivers, the top five, are travel and subsistence. We have a budget which is still unspent of 2.9 million, but the 2.9 million has subsequently been used. Just in the month of January and February, there's been increased travel to, amongst other places, Iran, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and was mainly around the security of fuel supply. Consultants and professional services. This area covers the auditor general fees, the audit committee fees, National Intelligence Agency, CSIR. We had an unspent balance of 6.3 million at December. However, this money has subsequently moved. The biggest cost driver here is the auditor general. Lease payments. It covers office accommodation, lease payments for equipment. We had 12.9 million unspent at December, but subsequent to December, the amount has reduced substantially. Operating payments covers mostly membership fees to local and international organizations. We had about a million left, but after January and February, this amount has been cleared. Venues and facilities. It's used mainly for the conferences, the indabas, the energy sharing information sessions, and the month of March has been designated the energy month, so much of this money will be used within the month of March. Still under the overview, you would find a huge underspend in capital expenditure. Much of the money has been set aside for the relocation to the new land bank building. Earlier on, a question was raised. The capital expenditure for this move has not been budgeted for, but whatever money was allocated in the financial year of 2011-2012 was set aside mainly for the relocation, and the relocation has been delayed due to internal processes at DPW. And further to that, EDIH assets was also transferred to the department, hence DOE purchased lower quantities of assets than originally planned for. Chair, going into the program overview, the first program being administration. It is overspent by 3.2%, but under administration, in slides still to come, I will unpack it for you by economic classification. Energy policy and planning is underspent by 33.2%. Energy regulation, underspent by 30.2%. National electrification program, underspent by 3%. Nuclear energy and regulation, underspent by 0.5%. But these results are as of December. Subsequent to that, there have been many events that have changed these variances. Program 1, administration, covers the ministry, the director general, corporate services, chief operating officer, and the CFO branch. Within this program, the overspend is within compensation of employees, and this overspend is mainly due to vacancies or postponed outside the approved structure. And I'll give two examples of such, since the DDG is here. The chief operating officer has had funds for the risk department and risk and evaluation and monitoring. However, there were just one post in each of those subdirectorates. There was a need for support staff. So that support staff has been filled and led to some of the variance. Goods and services is underspent by 0.8%, but this money will be spent in the following 2 months. It's a very small variance. Transfers and subsidies, it has we have an underspend, but this is mainly due to reduced payments to departing employees. These are payments for gratuities and leave pay. So we haven't had many resignations, so this funds have not been used. CAPEX, as you can see, the biggest variance lies within the administration department program. This was money set aside for the relocation, which I've explained earlier on. The move was originally planned for 1 April. This could not take place due to various challenges. The delay by DPW on the approval of the project manager for the relocation, delayed approval of the building itself by DPW. The bill of quantities is still in progress at DPW, which is still not yet finalized. So this money, as you can see, it's unspent, but it was purely earmarked for us to use for the relocation. I am, at all costs, going to have this money transferred with the bill of quantity, even if it's part payment, we're going to use it. Chair, under Program 2, Energy Policy and Planning, compensation of employees, we are underspent by 15.3%. Goods and services, we are underspent by 51.2%. Transfers and subsidies by 33.3%. Compensation of employees, as the COO spoke of earlier on, there are vacancies within the department, and this is the variance. Transfer payments, it's mainly due to the Transnet Petroleum Pipeline. The $375 million for December was not transferred on time, but subsequently in January the payment has been made. And I think there is a concern that I think it has been raised at the last meeting. The fourth quarter payment, Transnet and the department is working closely, and I think the payment has already reached finance for payment. Goods and services, the year-to-date spending is under by $7.5 million, but the unspent funds within this branch have been subsequently used. Program 3, energy regulation. Compensation of employees is underspent by 4.2%. It's mainly due to the vacancies. Goods and services, we've got no unspent money. Transfers and subsidies, we are underspent by 34.1%. Of this amount, $278 million was available for transfer at the end of December, and only $183 million was transferred, resulting in an underspend of $95 million. And the main reasons for this underspend, or money that weren't transferred, it was working for energy, a $17.5 million below budget. Subsequently, the department and Saneri revised the program and have identified a service provider, and the payment to the supplier is being processed. So that $17.5 million will be rectified in the next quarter. Energy efficiency and demand side management to municipalities, $61.8 million not transferred as a result of municipalities not adhering to contractual obligations. Some of these are MOAs, the delay in finalizing these agreements, progress reports not being sent to the department. However, subsequent to December 2011, some of these challenges have been addressed by the department with these municipalities. EDI, the core funding of $11.7 million was not transferred. A submission for the reclassification has been submitted to National Treasury for approval. Program 4, National Electrification Program. Compensation of employees, there's an underspend of 0.3%. This is mainly due to the vacancies. Goods and services is overspent by 15.2%. Transfers and subsidies, underspent by 3.1%. The major contribution is the conditional grants payable to the municipalities, which was well below the DORA payment schedule that makes up the $81 million. However, subsequent to December, a revised schedule of payments has been effected, and payments in January and February happened according to the revised schedule. So payments there are substantially decreased. Program 5, Nuclear Energy and Regulation, compensation of employees is underspent by 22.1%, and this is mainly due to vacancies that have not been filled as yet. And the underspend in goods and services in the outsourced expenditure services category, but subsequent to December, the saving has been utilized within the branch and within other areas within the Department of Energy. I think that is all on Program 5, Chair. The next slide, Chair, I would prefer to go a bit slower because there are some details that I think the members would want to know. Okay, the first one is transit pipelines. I think I spoke about the 375. As of 31 March, the full $1.5 billion will be paid over. The next one, EEDSM, that's the energy efficiency. We had $61.8 million unspent at December. The final balance as of the end of February is sitting at $27 million. But there has been an issue with the Nelson Mandela municipality here. I think a losing bidder did try to interdict one of the projects. The municipality also ran out of time to deliver on their contractual obligations. But the Department of Energy has tried to work with them very closely. The last tranche of payments to this municipality has been stopped, and Treasury has been informed accordingly. And I think the DG Electricity is here, and he can provide more details on this one. But in the next few days, we will be finalizing what will eventually go to the municipality or what won't be paid over. But there are earmarked funds. Energy efficiency, payments to Eskom is no. Repsol has got a balance of 10.2, but at the end of Feb, it's down to no. EDI, that money that we have left here of 8.8, we are waiting for approval. Treasury declined our reclassification request, but we've requested a deviation, and that's awaiting approval. So I think in the next week we should have it. But the money of 8.8, this money has been, an expense has been identified. So we are going to use it, and it will be within the electricity branch as well, REMT. Working for Energy, it's got $17.5 million. As of the end of February, it's down to no. Seneli has a negative balance of 3.3. This was paid according to the old DORA schedule. Subsequent to December, a revised schedule was done, and this has now normalized. Program 4, INEPT payments to municipalities. It's underspent by 88.7. But as of March, it's on par, and I think the balance is down to no. And the next one is INET non-grid. It's overspent by 7.8 here as well. It was paid according to the old DORA schedule. Subsequent to December, it has been revised. And I think the balance as of now, it's at $13 million. And this one, Chair, unfortunately, we can't give you a balance of where it's going to finish off until we have the final discussions with that branch. The local organizing committee, there's $1 million left over, but this is earmarked funds, and I cannot use it for any other expense, and that $1 million will be surrendered to National Treasury. Chair, note the comment, but I can't do it. Program 5, the NNR. No, that is nothing there. Next is no. The last one is the households, and I've explained earlier on, Chair, this is purely for gratuities and leave pay that we pay to departing employees, and there have been fewer resignations. Chair, for the entire financial year, we have $5.8 billion that we had to transfer. As of December, we transferred $4.6 in totality, but I think as we close the financial year, we are going to be left with a balance, and I will explain it in the next slide. The following slide, I'll explain it. Chair, I've included this slide. It gives us the MTF allocations for the next three financial years. But what I wanted to highlight was, for the new financial year starting on the 1st of April 2012, the budget is $6.8 billion, which is 9.7% increase from the 2011-12 budget. And for the following year, 2013-14, there's been a decrease of 6.1%, that is $460 million less, mainly in energy policy and planning. And the last financial year, for 2014-15, there's an increase of 9.6%, mainly in energy regulation and INEP. Chair, these are indicative baselines for now, so they can change with the adjustment periods as well. But it's purely here for information, and I wanted to share the new financial year that's about to start, 2012-13, that we have a budget of $6.8 billion. Chair, I just want to state on this $6.8 billion, and you've also noticed from the previous slide in terms of the transfers, almost 95% of our budget is used for transfers to municipalities and other implementing agents. But the operational money to provide the oversight functions on this money that have been transferred is nil. And we've tried many a times to engage National Treasury. We're hoping in the new financial year when it opens, they will consider at least giving us a 0.5% of the total transfer budget. Because I believe the INET program, and I think the DDG Electricity is here, who can add to that as well, that there'll be more work and a better oversight function performed as we have, if we do get that operational budget. And it will prevent us returning funds to Treasury because we would have that additional capacity to mobilize those funds. Chair, on the next slide, I believe the committee would have wanted to see where we would end the financial year, which is 2 weeks away. We've received a budget of $6.2 billion. We're anticipating to end the financial year with the $53.5 million in transfer payments, which is still under question. I'm not saying we're going to return it just yet, but it's under question. The slide has been prepared to show a projection of the actual cumulative expenditure till the 29th of February of $5.4 billion, which you see in the second column. That's where Feb is finally finished off. We have a year-to-date balance of $739 million. Of the $739 million left over at the end of Feb, I believe we will use $682 million, leaving us with an unspent balance of $53 million. But, Chair, as I stated, that the transfer payments are under discussion, and the next slide will give us how that $53 million is made up. Our apologies, EDI has the typo there. It should have been 11.7. The department requested for a reclassification, but it was declined. But another proposal has been sent through for a deviation, and we're awaiting approval there. The local organizing committee, the amount that was budgeted and the actual invoice that we received was $1 million less. Hence, we have to surrender that money back to Treasury. Energy efficiency to municipalities, there's a $27 million. As we've explained, there were challenges with some of the municipalities. The last tranche was unspent, and DOE is holding back the last payment. INEP payments to municipalities, $13.5 million. Here, Chair, the department, or maybe the supplier, has had difficulty securing funding, so this project couldn't take off. The department tried to assist where possible, but unfortunately we're also governed by rules and regulations. There are certain help that we can give in terms of advice, which I think the department has given. The electricity branch has helped the supplier in that way. But further than that, we couldn't assist. We are not allowed to pay for the suppliers, components or anything or pay upfront. So that was a delay there. And the last was the households. But, Chair, as I'm saying, this was a projection. Anything could change from the $53.5 million, and the work has been, in the last few weeks, also underway. So I cannot for certain say we are going to finish off at $53.5 million. Thank you, Chair, and I think that's all. And, oh, I just wanted to raise two things, Chair. One was, I think the question was asked earlier, I'm not sure I fully covered it. The bill of quantities for the relocation to land bank is being estimated at 20 million rand. 20 million, the bill of quantities. But that process is still underway with DPW. They have not finalized. So at all costs, I will try and at least make part payment. I don't want to if I can oversend some of it, I'm going to. And there'll be two routes there. Either it will be approved or it will be deducted from my next budget. But I am going to try to. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Slav.
Sir, just one.
Let me take hands first.
Oh.
Matinto. Sorry. Oh. What happened? Sure, it's been a long day. It's been a long day. Honorable Matibela, Honorable Hadel. I think that's all. Okay?
Just a quick word, Chairperson. The CFO says the money will be spent, except for 53. And the reasons given in the last slide show how that 53 will be. And it doesn't suggest that the result of vacancies that exist would form part of that 53 million. I know that procedures of government in employment are very slow. It takes 6 months to employ, you know, advertise, leave them there for 2 months and then shortlist. Leave them there for another 2 months, then interview. And leave them there for another 2 months, then you can avoid. And this says to you, if those processes have not taken place so far, it goes without saying that this money is going to have to go through into the next financial year or to be returned to treasury. What would be your take, Diego?
The next one is
Thank you, Chair. I just would like to, you know, with the CFO, your late payments due to municipalities not achieving their obligations with DOE, they are also bound by certain financial rules. And the effect that DORA will have on that, us transferring late, they've got to return that back later to Treasury, because we're doing a sort of a dumping onto them, and then they not being able to. Has some of these municipalities indicated that this is maybe a possibility? The overspending of on some of your votes. Especially on the compensation of employees, and I do understand the principle behind it. But how's that going to reflect onto your AG report? Will it reflect as a possible irregular expenditure because we've gone that way? I just would like to understand how I'm going to read your AG report, in a year's time when I look back at this. Your concerns with DPW, obviously it's the concern. It goes also to your unexpenditure money of the 53 million rand that sits at the end, I would presume. Not because you haven't allocated that out, you haven't paid that out because not all the processes is in place in order to get to your transfer of offices. I'm just trying to understand how the rollover actually works, because all the paperwork and all the obligations is not into place, you know, the financial constraint. And does that also make did you also make provision, because you currently the DMR and DOE has got a shared network services, so obviously there's a Either someone is going to take responsibility of the old network, and you will be taking responsibility of a new network. The actual implications on that, because I was reading in your annual report, trying to see where this whole move of offices are going to, you know, from the one building and the implications, and there's very little in this book that gives me a indication on how your strategic objectives are going to be and your risk that is there, because one of the actual risk that you might be sitting with is where agreements are in place with other offices, and you might have got to pull away lease agreements that you're not getting to the financial towards, I don't want to say a handshake must, but some sort of financial agreement must come to place if you had a financial arrangement with another institution, especially with a lease agreement, and you want to stop that lease agreement towards the ending. Is there indications currently that you might have got to pay I don't want to say penalties, but call it penalties, that this move will occur other expenses because of stoppages of other lease agreements, and who will carry that? Will it be yourself, or will it be DMR or DPV? I just would like to understand that one. The late payments on some of these transfers, did it result to some sort of penalties, either by yourself or either by the entities that you transfer financial resources because of payments that are being transferred late? Is there a result of penalties? If so, how do you deal with it?
Okay, thank you. Honorable Adam, because you're a new chairperson here, let me say one thing. Speeches are for the House, and here is direct questions. Let's be direct with questions.
Thanks, Chair. One of my questions has been asked in relation to, as you going to have these 53, million, being left, what is the implication in terms of your HE report? But the other thing is that in terms of your energy efficiency, that 27 billion and the INEP, 13 billion. I'm trying to get you to understand that what plans do you have to assist the municipalities? Because my understanding is that this is not the first time having the very same challenges. If you remember correctly, last year, the chairperson also emphasized that you must come up with strategies in aligning your systems with the municipalities. The other aspect, I'm trying to check in terms of this service provider that is failing to render services. What is going to happen with it? No? Thanks.
Thank you, chairperson.
Yes, thank you so much.
I think Honorable Khadebe has taken some of the questions that I wanted to ask. I've got just one about the municipalities as well, just to take it forward. That is it not because, is it not the service delivery protest, is it not because of financial implications that they are having? Because they cannot, set some of the municipalities cannot, bring they don't meet your.
Thank you.
Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try and answer. I see there were a lot of questions around the 53 million, and I think I must start there. 53 million is less than 1% of the total transfers that we've had. And Chair, from the last financial year to this financial year that we're about to close, I think we've come a long way in terms of the department. And as much as the department may have assisted the municipalities where there were service delivery issues, non-compliance agreements that were delayed,
I think the electricity branches assisted them substantially in getting them to comply, so the money could have been transferred in terms of the DORA. I think the department has gone further than they call in assisting in that manner. And it's less than 1%, as I'm saying, but this is just a projection as a snapshot when I got here. And the work is still underway. So in the next two to three weeks, this figures could be changing. So I say that is where I would like to leave that one, Chair. And the others, I see there were a lot of questions around DPW and the concerns raised there. The bill of quantity, as of Monday at our EXCO meeting, it was clarified that the finalized bill of quantities will be available from DPW on Wednesday. So I think that is being taken care of. It's unfortunate that the DDG Corporate Services is not here. He could have provided you with a little bit more detail there. With DMR, there is no signed lease between DOE and DMR. It is, I think, worked in the benefit of the department. But DMR has been informed that we are vacating the premises. So that as well, the DDG Corporate Services, has had that meeting. For the new building, as I stated earlier on, the anticipated move would have been on 1 April. It didn't happen as such due to many challenges, and I think also operationally, the finance department couldn't relocate on the 1st of April. We're in the midst of year-end, so it wouldn't suit us. There has been a grace period as part of the agreement, and I think that goes up right up to June or 1 July. There's a three-month grace period. So we can still move right up to 1 July. We have that period to successfully relocate from Trevena, where we are, to Land Bank. Over and above that, if we do not move within that period, there will be wasteful expenditure incurred by the department. If that can clarify that one. Then under employees, compensation of employees, we are projecting that we will not overspend as of 31 March. The overspends and the underspends between the categories with the final environment that we request from Treasury will clear those ones out. And there was one question, I think, under vacancies and the rollover. The rollover of this 53.5 million, our first port of call, and it'll be the first price, is for us to request the rollover and let it be approved by Treasury. So it is a watertight motivation that we request from the department and from those branches that are affected, and we really try to negotiate for that rollover. And I think around June, July, Treasury normally confirms if it's been approved or not. And I think in terms of the last question on the municipalities, Mr. Pani was going to assist on that one. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks. Honorable Chair, the transfer payments, specifically the 53 million, if I think we need to understand it in the context of the rules around how we make those transfers to municipalities in particular. Of that 53 million, then, the biggest chunk, half of it, more than half of it, is the transfer to Nelson Mandela Bay Municipality. And the Division of Revenue, as the Division of Revenue Act, as Honorable Smale indicates, provisions would apply here. And the rules are that because we are withholding a transfer, we have, under those circumstances where there is a problem with the municipality, we have to inform National Treasury and inform with the municipality. That has all been done. So it is not just a question of us, you know, withholding for, you know, reasons that would breach the Division of Revenue Act. We're still working within the framework of DORA. The other side of it is that we can still, having regard to the risks of transferring the money to the municipality, we can still get to a position where ourselves and National Treasury can still transfer the money to the municipality. And that would substantially bring the underspend to even less than, even more less than 1%. You know, so it's still a decision that we need to make. But you know, I think it would also be a little bit disingenuous if we came here and said
we have transferred all of the money knowing that there's nothing that will happen on the outside. The output would not be achieved. So we have been transparent in saying that there is a problem with the municipality because they have been in some court process, and under the circumstances, it's appropriate that we transfer, that we withhold the money. The rules, incidentally, also make provision. I mean, the money can be, we can apply for a rollover with the appropriate motivation that, you know, the once the municipality has got their act together, you know, we can pursue the outputs as originally planned. But that's the DORA in relation to municipalities. The other part of the problem, which is the 13 million rand, is in relation to a contractual position with a specific private sector service provider. In other words, not a municipality, because if it was a municipality, it's fine. You know, we can transfer and the money will be safe because the provisions of the MFMA would protect the money on the other side. In this case, the provisions of the PFMA come in where we are not allowed to transfer money for services that have not been rendered. Right? So the 13 million rand cannot be transferred in relation to a solar home systems program. What happened here is that the, and I think the CFO did indicate, in the previous financial year, we had a much bigger problem. I think we applied for a 55 million rand rollover around the solar home systems program. And the service providers, we have four of them, have been battling to clear that backlog. So what happened is that the rollover money was approved. So they had 2011-12 funding plus the 50-something million rollover from the previous financial year. They've all been able to clear it, but the service provider has not been able to spend all of that 18 million rand that is still left in the program. So for us, the PFMA does not allow us to transfer that money, and we're quite happy to, you know, to not transfer the money because we're in breach of the PFMA. Just in terms of the implications of this is that we think that because they are currently implementing the solar home systems program, it does not mean that they are not able to, you know, to deliver the service. The service is being provided. It's just that they would not be able to provide 13 million rands worth of additional. And what is the 13 million? It's mainly in relation, and we have to explain what this is all about. The four service providers have entered into concession agreement, 20-year agreement, in terms of which they install the solar home systems and they maintain them over the life cycle. Right? So they have an area that is demarcated and they install these things. And all that it means is that, yes, they will still continue servicing those that have been impacted, but they will not be able to start new areas. That's what the implication of that means. They will only be able to start it in the new financial year once they have cleared the backlog. So one could argue that it is not necessary. It's delayed service, definitely, yes, but it is not, you know, related whatsoever to the service delivery protests that we've seen out there. The areas that are affected, incidentally, it's in the Vembe district in northern Limpopo. It's in the Eastern Cape, district 13, which is around the Amatole kind of area, the part of the country. And then we have Midlands of KZN, which is the third concession, and around the I can't remember the municipality, the district municipalities involved, but it's in the central and the northern part, the Midlands part of KZN. And then the fourth one would be in the Eastern Cape as well. We've got two concessions in the Eastern Cape, so it could be, and it's not your typical service delivery protest hotspots, if I can put it that way. Just to also indicate, Chair, that one of the other service delivery issues that has come out of this program very quickly is that we have been approached to increase the footprint of solar home systems in other areas. So as opposed to it creating a sense that the program is dying, the program is actually expanding in the new financial year. In fact, in our strategic plan, I think we said we're going to do 20,000 solar home systems. I can't remember the actual number. We're going to do more than what we've done. Thank you.
Thank you. thank you. Come to the last part of the legislative program. Can we just deal with page 3 of it? I assume that members are aware of the ISMO bill. It was presented for us. Mr. Pani has taken us through the provisions of the bill. The Electricity Regulation Second Amendment Bill, I'm also told that we had a briefing on that bill together with the Energy Regulator Amendment Bill. So we'd only be left with two bills, that's Gas Amendment Bill and the New Petroleum Products Bill. Can we just get a brief explanation of the bill and where they are in less than 3 minutes?
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the House. I've already alluded to the fact that the Gas Act, Gas Amendment Act, will serve to the to cabinet in the next, not this cabinet sitting, but the next cabinet sitting.
Can you just explain even the objective of the bill? Sorry.
The objective of the bill is to mainly is to be able to update the Act to incorporate changes in the business landscape, particularly to be able to, amongst other things, incorporate other forms and technologies of gas storage and transportation, like LNG, which is liquefied natural gas, as well as CNG, which is compressed natural gas, as well as tighten up the enforcement, the compliance monitoring and enforcement aspects of the Act, dealing with issues of offenses and penalties and how to enforce that, as well as strengthening the issue of inspections of the site and deal with registrations of activities, as well as licensing. Look at the setting of licenses and not just the approval of licenses by the regulator, to give some, to sort of give the regulator some teeth. So that is the Gas Amendment Act. The Petroleum Products Amendment Act, the Act has already been amended twice. It's an old Act of 1977, 820 of 1977. It was amended by Act number 58 of 2003, as well as Act number 2 of 2005. Now what to amend is also to bring that Act to up to date with developments in the industry, as well as also do the same in terms of tightening the compliance monitoring and enforcement, because even if you can catch a person red-handed in terms of the Act, you need to give a person an opportunity to correct the situation before you can really impose penalties. So that on its own just makes it very lame. So this is one issue that you need to deal with. There are also other technical issues that are included. For example, the possibility of providing waivers where there are some fuel specification challenges in the country without having to declare an emergency. So it's some of the things that you'd like to still be looking at. And then to also deal with provisions that are obsolete. That is in the main what we aim to do with the Petroleum Products Act. Thank you.
Thank you, Department, and honorable members. To meet again next week.